You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Omali Yeshitela, who is chairman of the Black Is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations. The website is blackisbackcoalition.org. He has agreed to speak at the upcoming April 4th No to NATO, Yes to Peace events in Washington, D.C. The website for that is notonato.org. Chairman Omali is also chairman of the African People's Socialist Party, USA, and the African Socialist International, and is the founder of the Burning Spear newspaper. See theburningspear.com. Omali Yeshitela, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much. It's good to be with you.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us a little bit about the Black Is Back Coalition.
Well, the Black Is Back Coalition is an organization that was founded in September of 2009. We felt it extremely necessary to pull this organization together. The coalition is an organization of organizations and institutions and some individuals, but after the election of Barack Hussein Obama, we found so many people, Africans and people, white people, et cetera, losing the ability to criticize the United States policies, war policies, and other policies, precisely because, or primarily because, it now had a it was represented by a black face in the form of Obama. And we felt that was extremely dangerous for a number of reasons, not the least of which being that historically African people in this country have been opposed to war, wars of aggression, and that the election of Barack Hussein Obama created a tremendous amount of hysteria in the African community, with people enthusiastically embracing him as though something new had happened in terms of some transformation had happened in terms of the United States government itself. And not only were African people ecstatic about his election and apparently unable to offer any criticism of Obama, the same was true of what is usually characterized as the peace movement or the anti-imperialist movement or the white left in general. This is what we found, and we thought it was extremely dangerous. And another reason that the coalition came together was because we found that the traditional peace movement or anti-war movement too often overlooked the kinds of wars that were inflicting horrible damage and have been inflicting damage and just terrible consequences on people around the world on an ongoing basis, not just occasionally, like in Haiti, like the indigenous peoples, people right here in the Americas, who nobody speaks of unless they happen to be in the room where they exist in concentration camps, euphemistically referred to as Indian reservations. And generally speaking, we don't hear discussions about what's happening in Philippines and on ongoing basis and various other places, including in the barrios and so-called ghettos that African people occupy in this country. So we felt like it was extremely important to intervene and to contribute to a new definition of war and peace as it was as is applied in this world and certainly in this country. And we also recognize that the historical sort of divide, apparent divide, where that sees a peace movement, anti-war movement that is generally white, even as we see polls indicating that the majority of white people have been for various wars of aggression and the majority of African people have been opposed to them. We felt like there was a reason for that, and not the least of which was that the African people are constantly engaged in struggle, in war on a daily basis, And we felt like the question of peace had to be closely associated with what's happening to African people. And we have an obligation to mobilize African people and others around questions happening to Africans here and other places around the world as a part of the struggle for peace. And that so that's part of what brought us together. And so that was in September 12th. We had our first meeting right in Washington, D.C., 2009. And at that meeting in September, we decided to hold a national mobilization at the White House, a march on the White House, a rally first and a march on the White House. And this was the first national mobilization that occurred against the Obama regime, and the only black national mobilization that criticized and challenged the Obama regime. So that's some history. And then there are some really noted persons and groups that came on board to participate in this coalition. And it has lasted, has existed since then up to this point where the crisis that drew us into this coalition has deepened tremendously and is spilling over everywhere. That contributes to even the No to NATO, Yes to Peace mobilization that's happening within the next few weeks.
I do remember when Black is Back Coalition got started, and speaking with a friend of mine, Glenn Ford, about it. Some of your members and allies I have been in touch with for many years, and I remember Glenn remarking about a poll that was done, I believe, about war in Syria. It may have been the war in Libya, but I think it was Syria, that for the first time in history, he said, had found greater support among black people in the United States for a war than among white people, that it had never been that way before.
Yes.
Is this sort of what's meant by the is back in the name Black is Back?
That is sort of what's meant by is back. But, you know, another thing that happened that really does not get generally recognized is that there was an incredibly significant movement of black people in the 1960s that it didn't just go away of its own volition, that assassinations, removed Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and Fred Hampton and members of the Black Panther Party literally crushed our movement. And what replaced the movement was this substitute kind of politic that Barack Hussein Obama is a tremendous reflection of, but not just Obama. I mean, we see it even in the upcoming election. We see people who are being put forth, et cetera, but none of them raising the kind of critical issues that for black people that were being raised in the 1960s. So what we said is the election of Obama, the proclamation by so many liberals, black and white, that we had achieved an end to the racial oppression in this country, the black struggle sort of disappeared and was replaced in many ways by the Democratic Party. And the Democratic Party's quietness is kept. There's never been a revolutionary organization. And so we felt like it was really critical to make that statement, both to ourselves as black people and to the world, that it is possible to unite with the legitimate interests and aims of African people in this country through uniting with this coalition.
It seems like with Trump moving into the White House and replacing Obama, one might have expected, and I had something of this expectation, that finally putting a Republican in that office, and not just a Republican, but a white man and an openly obnoxious and vicious and racist white man, all of that sort of vanishing of the peace movement that happened in the lead up to Obama moving into the White House would be undone, and you might see crowds in the streets again against the wars. That expectation has, of course, been dramatically disappointed thus far. How do you explain that the peace movement really isn't back?
Well, I think one of the real issues, and it's really interesting you should mention that, because What is war and peace and what's left and right in this country anymore? I mean, look at what we see, how the Democratic Party that has posed for generations as the doves, and the Republicans been painted as the hawks and pro-war. And now what we see, this really what is apparently a bizarre situation where the Democratic Party and many of the liberals are protesting the fact that NATO is being challenged by Trump, or was being challenged by Trump, protesting the fact that Trump seemed at one point to be cozying up to Russia, or certainly trying to revamp the relationship with Russia. Now the thing with the what they call North Korea. I mean, it's interesting that the, some of the that this unity with right and left and opposition to Trump's moves in this direction. So I think part of what has happened is that it's a crisis of the system itself that made this election of Barack Hussein Obama necessary. It's a whole new direction for the empire. The I think we even saw some evidence of it once Obama was in. We talked about the Asia pivot, and this caused some tremors among the traditional Atlanticists, as you know, the Atlanticists, which gave birth to the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, United Nations, all this, the whole new that arrangement that has generally guided the direction of the imperial powers of the world over the last 70 years. But it has been tattered, has been it's being challenged in a very serious way, and Trump was the most overt, obvious one to challenge that. And I think that the situation with Obama, you remember Obama was given a peace prize, and at the when he was even accepting the Nobel Peace Prize, he made a war presentation. And I think it has confused a lot of people. What are we looking at? Who is the right and who is the left anymore? And I think that's one of the reasons that makes this coalition so important, because it's not enough to just call for peace in our estimation, because George Bush would have accepted peace if it meant that the people who were being bombed and killed would not fight back. They just wanted to be able to oppress and exploit the people without any kind of confrontation. And I think that's what we're looking at today, a whole social system that rests on a parasitic relationship with the vast majority of the world, in a world where something like 80% of the people on the planet are trying to survive off US dollars or less, and 50% trying to survive off $2.50 or less. I think that this parasitic relationship that the vast majority of the people on Earth has enjoyed with America and with other imperial powers is what's being challenged. And I think, unfortunately, that from the left and the right, people see their interest being challenged and are confused. Many people, honest people, are confused about what stance to take. I mean, there's not a single liberal I've heard. I haven't heard any of the doves that's running for office, that's talking about running for office, coming out in opposition to the starvation that's being imposed on the people in Venezuela, the obvious coup attempt that's being made there, and in various other places. So the peace movement is confused when the question of peace now does not clarify whether one stands on the side of or in opposition to imperialism or the imperial arrangement that starves and bleeds the rest of the world for the benefit of the U.S. And for much of Europe.
We're speaking with Omali Yeshitela, who is chairman of the Black is Back Coalition. The website is blackisbackcoalition.org. I watched a speech that you gave, a video of a speech that you gave at Oxford in a debate on the topic of African unity and other topics. And it occurred to me that not just Barack Obama was given a Nobel Peace Prize, but the European Union was given a Nobel Peace Prize while European nations were were waging numerous wars, just not against each other.
Yeah.
And everybody's got a theory for peace in Africa, but they never seem to recommend what they celebrate in Europe, and that is Union of Africa. Why is that?
Well, because if you saw the presentation that I made at Oxford, one of the salient points, I think, is the fact that the division in Africa is something that was done by Europe, where European powers in 1884 and 85 sat on a table in Berlin and split Africa up. And part of the reason they divided Africa, we've seen this process happening over and over again, leading to the advent of the League of Nations and the United Nations, is that they were attempting to avoid war among the imperial powers of the European powers by doing what mafia dons often do, sit at a table and divide up the pot and say, okay, share it out to each other. And so I think that's part of what we see. And so we have a situation where the continent of Africa, something like only 3 to 7% of what is called trade happens among African people on the continent, with the vast majority of resources going outward to Europe and other places. And Africa, though bountiful in terms of natural resources and its potential for agriculture, for hydroelectric power, et cetera, the African people in Africa and around the world are starving and living under horrible conditions, because this is a process that feeds the whole imperialist system. And that's the thing that's going on. And so nobody talks about uniting Africa. And because a united Africa would mean that it would be impossible for England to be able to deal with Nigeria at the expense of some other former colony that it has in Africa, or at the expense of one of the 14 neo-colonies that France controls up to this day, taking 65% of the gross domestic product off the top. Africa would be able to speak with one voice, just as China is able to speak with one voice. When England deals with China, it deals with one China. When the U.S. deals with China, it deals with one China. But when they deal with Africa, they can deal with 54 different Africas, and that plays to the advantage of the imperialists and the disadvantage of Africa and African people worldwide. So that's why they won't have it. And it's really interesting, because Kwame Nkrumah, who the former president of the independent the newly independent Ghana, really struggled for this united Africa, and was overthrown, by the way, by CIA, by Lyndon Baines Johnson's CIA in 1966, because of the work that he had been doing and continued to do to unite Africa. So that is a major contradiction that we are faced with. And I want to say that we're speaking, that's true of Africa, but it's true of oppressed peoples everywhere, that it requires a tremendous amount of disunity for the imperialists to continue to suck out resources. And that's what's happening in Venezuela today, how now they can play Colombia against the reactionary government of Colombia. The reactionary government, they know the reactionary government, even if they want to pretend that Colombia is just some neutral force, they know about what just happened in Brazil, where the new president is has been characterized as fascist and somebody who is promoting the destruction of the rainforest and the crushing the indigenous peoples there. I mean, all of them are working with the U.S. government, with Trump, with the rest of them, to destabilize and overturn the government of Venezuela. So this is extremely problematic. It's a problematic that even the people who claim that they hate Donald Trump, they hate what he stands for, who claim that they are opposed to the Russian, so-called Russian intervention in American elections, can stand by while one guy stands up and say, I am now the president, and then the U.S. government can say, okay, he's the president, and round up a whole bunch of other folk to say he's the president, despite the fact that he never ran for the office. It's like Caesar crowning himself, with the help, of course, in this instance, of the United States government. So this keeping the people disunited is fundamental to the strategic control of the whole world by the imperial powers.
Very well said. So NATO is now coming on April 4th to celebrate itself in Washington, D.C., foreign ministers from NATO nations. And April 4th, to many of us, is a date on which Martin Luther King Jr. gave an anti-war speech and then exactly 1 year later was assassinated. What do you make of NATO and of the significance of that date?
I think I really appreciate you because many people don't recognize what happened on April 4th, 1967 at Riverside Church in New York, where King made an anti-war speech, but he also, in that speech, challenged his continued continued ability in the middle of all the struggles that Africans and other people were involved in, to proclaim that people had to fight nonviolently, as violent as America was in the United States. And it was a year to that day, as you mentioned, April 4th, 1968, that he was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, during a struggle by black workers, the sanitation workers of that city. And this anniversary, and by the way, 2 days after his assassination, as quiet as it's kept, young little Bobby Hutton, from the Black Panther Party, I think 16 or 17 years old at the time, was killed in Oakland, California. So assassination became the means by which political criticism was happening in this country. You know, and there's a whole array of assassinations. Look at the Sixers. You're looking at Malcolm. You're looking at King. You're looking at the members of the Black Panther Party. More than 30 members of the Black Panther Party killed in 1968 alone. So it was a whole terroristic war that was waged against our movement. That's why we have to say Black is back, that you didn't succeed. And that Fred Hampton was absolutely correct when he said you can kill a revolutionary, but you can't kill the revolution. So King's anniversary and NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, an organization of imperial powers, created as an organization of imperial powers that was designed, among other things, to contain what was perceived by many at the time as the workers' revolutionary of the Soviet Union, obviously to contain the Soviet Union, and also to be this force that could continue to dominate the world collectively, have this collective military force of all imperial powers, and that's what NATO was created for. And it's been a horrible institution, as you suggested about what happened with Libya, the role it played there, and it's been a terroristic organization. So even when it wasn't killing and destroying people, it was a horrible threat that could be used against people, like atomic weapons and the like.
We've got just about 5 minutes left, and I really would love at least your beginning of your answer to this question, because it's something that makes building big coalitions difficult sometimes, and that is the research that people like Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan and others have done that have found that movements over the past century or so that have overthrown oppressive power have been over twice as likely to succeed, and those successes have been far longer lasting when they have been nonviolent. So what is the argument to advocate for violent revolution, even if it's less likely to succeed?
Well, I don't think the question is to argue for violent revolution. I think the question is to argue for revolution, that the people have to be free. And I think that we make a horrible error if we say that there's a limit on what people can do to win their freedom. And then we also have to ask the question what success means. If success allows for the continuation of the same kind of social system that's bleeding everybody and bleeding
the
countries, that's going to be extremely problematic. So I think those are questions that we have to entertain. And I also think that it's important for us to be able to allow people who engage in genuine struggles for liberation to set the terms of what freedom means and how they're going to achieve those that freedom, and not to stand on the wayside saying that we can only accept your struggle for freedom if it happens on the terms that we think are moral and good.
Well, I'm not talking about accepting or allowing or decreeing or giving orders. I'm talking about recommending and suggesting what seems to work best is what might be most advantageous to use.
Well, I wasn't challenging your observation when I said that. I wasn't speaking to you, the individual, but that has been a contest that has pervaded our struggles, at least since the 1960s, because there have been people who would consistently say that they could not support. There are people who said, this is somebody who's locked up forever, been in prison forever, and clearly framed up, but we can't support them because they advocated violence, or we can't support freeing them. So I wasn't speaking specifically to you, just the confrontations that this movement has had over the many years in trying to win our freedom. And when the people in Nicaragua first raised up in the 1970s to win their freedom, we didn't know a single Nicaraguan. It didn't have to. We just knew they were fighting against the same kind of social system, and that their struggle represented a crisis for that system. And so we turned over all, that's the African People's Socialist Party, turned over all of the resources that we had to them, just as a matter of solidarity. We didn't question how they were doing. We did the same thing with the Palestinians, the same thing with the Iranians, everybody who's been involved in those struggles, without trying to, say that they had to believe what we believe. We just knew that they had a right to make that struggle, and we didn't try to set the terms for them. Now, this is, again, not a suggestion that's what you said, but what I'm responding to it from my perspective and how we view things. I know that's true of the African People's Socialist Party, and I suspect that's generally true of the coalition as well. In fact, I know it's true because of various principles of unity that we've created for the coalition.
Well, we are very much looking forward to these events in April in Washington, D.C. People can find out more at notonato.org. Chairman Omali Yeshitela of the Black is Back Coalition will be speaking there. We've got just about 1 minute left. How can people find out more, support what you're doing, get involved with Black is Back?
Well, I think you mentioned it. They should go to blackisbackcoalition.org. And you can find out everything about us. And I'm calling on everybody to come out for the No to NATO, Yes to Peace mobilization actions that's going to be happening during that period of the 4th, 3rd, 4th, and I think something even happens earlier than that. And we're calling on people to come out. We're certainly trying to get as many Africans as we can to come out and participate in that. So just go to blackisbackcoalition.org, and you can find out all information about us and upcoming events that we're engaged in, independent of or separate from the No to NATO, Yes to Peace mobilization. I want to thank you so much for giving us this opportunity to speak to your listeners, and also for how gracious you've been in terms of, handling clearly some differences that we might have. Thank you so much.
Wonderful. Thank you to you. Again, the website for Chairman Omali Yeshitela's Black is Back Coalition is blackisbackcoalition.org, and there will be events all the way from March 30th through April 4th in Washington, D.C. Go to notonato.org. Chairman Omali, thank you very, very much for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, as a report from the Center for Responsive Politics Open Secrets website noted recently, pharmaceutical manufacturers and health insurance companies have a lot of points of disagreement these days about who's mainly to blame for high drug prices, for instance. But they agree on something. Medicare for All cannot become law. A group called the Partnership for America's Healthcare Future, that's a coalition of drug makers, insurance companies, and private hospitals, is lobbying hard to sink the popular proposal recently introduced in the House by Representative Pramila Jayapal. The coalition has such powerhouses as the AMA and Blue Cross Blue Shield on its side and spent some $143 million on lobbying in 2018 alone. On the other side, the growing majority of Americans who think a wealthy country can do better than forcing people to choose between buying insulin and paying their rent. Which side are corporate media on? Well, we're learning more about that every day. We'll talk about Medicare for All and the media with Diane Archer, founder and former president of the Medicare Rights Center. She's currently president of Just Care USA. That's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at recent press. A tweet from New York Times columnist Bret Stephens, approvingly quoted, calling it astute as usual, a statement from the National Review's David French, quote, "Our nation cannot maintain its culture of free speech if we continue to reward those who seek to destroy careers rather than rebut ideas," close quote. Were French and Stephens defending Ilhan Omar, Julian Assange? Haha, of course not. They were speaking in support of Fox host Tucker Carlson, who's facing some pressure from advertisers after the group Media Matters released audio of him on shock radio a few years back, saying things like Iraq is a, quote, crappy place filled with a bunch of, you know, semi-literate primitive monkeys, close quote. For champions of civility, like Bret Stephens, it's not this sort of statement that presents problems for public discourse, but any suggestion that the public could be better served. As Arizona activist Imran Siddiqui put it in a response tweet to Stephens, quote, "Ilhan quoted a Diddy lyric and you wrote 10 articles about it. Tucker called Iraqis monkeys and these are ideas to be rebutted," close quote. Well, the Timesman isn't the only one engaged in Carlson rehabilitation. The Washington Post, having already gifted readers with a Kathleen Parker column headed "Tucker Carlson, Don't Bow to the Mob," published a March 13th news report that explained, quote, "In one set of recordings, Carlson made controversial statements about child rape and comments that could be construed as misogynistic," close quote, which was immediately followed by a Carlson quote, quote, "If you're talking to a feminist and she's giving you, well, you know, men really need to be more sensitive. No, actually, men don't need to be more sensitive. You just need to be quiet and do what you're told," close quote. Well, I reckon that could be construed as misogynistic, as could just possibly, if one were inclined, Carlson's comment that, quote, "I mean, I love women, but they're extremely primitive. They're basic. They're not that hard to understand," close quote. As for his statements on child rape, they're only controversial if one imagines there's a substantial block of folks that share his view that Warren Jeffs should be free. The former head of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, Jeffs is serving a life sentence for assault and accomplice to rape, for example, arranging a marriage between a 14-year-old girl and her 19-year-old cousin. Jeffs himself had a wife who was 12 years old. But that's not really rape, Carlson explained. Quote, "The rapist in this case has made a lifelong commitment to love and take care of the person, so it is a little different." Close quote. Jeffs, Carlson maintains, was only persecuted for being unpopular with a different lifestyle. Tucker Carlson says he won't apologize for being caught saying something naughty more than a decade ago. Media Matters is clear that the tapes are relevant for a host who just a couple of months ago was saying immigrants make the U.S., quote, "poorer and dirtier and more divided," close quote. Says Media Matters President Angelo Carasone, quote, "We were actually helping people better understand just how vile your current Fox News show is by showing what that worldview really looks like," close quote. The New York Times recently warned Americans against the embrace of popular progressive policies, not in an editorial saying don't embrace popular progressive policies, but in a news article that reported that the rise of progressive presidential candidates is unnerving moderate Democrats who fear the party is, quote, "careening over a liberal cliff," close quote. Centrism is a standard bias in news coverage in elite outlets like The Times, The Washington Post, and supposedly non-corporate alternatives like NPR, as FAIR founder and author Jeff Cohen, now at Roots Action, wrote recently, presented as an absence of bias rather than the very particular worldview that it is. Media centrism sometimes takes the form of inaccurate critiques of popular policies like raising the minimum wage. But sometimes it shows up as inaccurate claims about the impact of right-wing or progressive extremism on U.S. elections. Cohen cites a good example of this status quo bias, a March 1st Washington Post news report that was really a warning, like that in the New York Times, about the progressive upsurge in the Democratic Party. Headlined, "Centrist Democrats Push Back Against Party's Liberal Surge," the piece signaled readers with the help of supposedly objective phrases in the reporter's voice, like "shoot the moon policy ideas" and "hardball tactics of liberal firebrands." It also quoted a half dozen sources from the corporate wing of the party and none from the progressive wing. But what struck Cohen most was the skewed history and math in this bit. Quote, "Some warned that imposing purity tests could lead to a Democratic version of the conservative Tea Party revolt that transformed the GOP in recent years. That surge has brought Republicans new energy and new voters, but it also cost the GOP some congressional races and legislative victories," close quote. Well, let's look at the numbers. When the Tea Party revolt began in early 2009, Democrats had the White House and 59 or 60 senators caucusing with them. Republicans now have the White House and 53 senators. Democrats had a huge majority in the House with 257 seats, but even after their big comeback win last November, Democrats now have 235 House seats. Democrats had 28 of 50 governorships in the country. The GOP now has 27 of 50. In 2009, Democratic state legislators outnumbered their Republican counterparts by 859 seats. Now the GOP has an edge of 379 over Democrats among state lawmakers. So, Cohen suggests, you could say the Tea Party upsurge cost the Republicans in morality or in compassion, but not in seats or political power. So while corporate media act as though they're trying to do Democrats a solid by offering some sort of reality check, the fact that their advice rests on flawed history gives us, shall we say, reason to question. And finally, listeners will likely know by now that the late February story, complete with vivid video footage about supporters of elected Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro burning trucks that were trying to bring the besieged country food and medicine, was false. Weeks later, the New York Times reported that the humanitarian trucks were not set on fire by Maduro's forces, but instead by anti-Maduro protesters who threw a Molotov cocktail. The New York Times outlined how the fake story took root, passing from U.S. officials to media that simply reported their claims as fact, with no investigation. Does any of that sound familiar? Folks like CNN's Marshall Cohen noted the Times debunking as if it were just an interesting development. A classic example of how misinformation spreads, Cohen said in a tweet. Except, as The Intercept's Glenn Greenwald pointed out, it was Cohen's own network, CNN, that led the way in spreading the lie around the world, and not simply by parroting official claims. On February 24th, the network told viewers that, quote, a CNN team saw incendiary devices from police on the Venezuelan side of the border ignite the trucks, close quote. It was then we got to Mike Pence claiming that the tyrant Maduro danced as his henchmen burned food and medicine. And Marco Rubio's comment that each of the trucks burned by Maduro carried 20 tons of food and medicine. This is a crime, and if international law means anything, he must pay a high price for this. And to Mike Pompeo's fist shaking, what kind of a sick tyrant stops food from getting to hungry people? It isn't merely that corporate media will never, in a million years, go back to each of these people and demand to know why they won't insist on the same sort of response now that it appears it was Maduro's opponents who were to blame. It's more that the very news dissemination process, here superficially being indicted, will not itself be reconsidered. After all, this false story arrived embedded within another false story that the Venezuelan government is blocking needed humanitarian aid to the country. The Venezuelan government has and does allow aid to their country from countries that are not actively and vituperatively threatening to overthrow the elected president with an external coup. Groups from the Red Cross to the UN have challenged the U.S.'s earnest claims of merely human interest, and even NPR acknowledged that the U.S.'s moves aren't just humanitarian, but, quote, also designed to foment regime change in Venezuela, which is why much of the international aid community wants nothing to do with it, close quote. Well, that plus the evidence that it was, in fact, opposition protesters that burned the trucks would suggest a real flipping of the current script, and with it, some consideration of how that script got written in the first place. But as happened with those raising questions about evidence of Saddam Hussein's possessions of weapons of mass destruction, or Iraq's throwing babies out of incubators, or North Vietnam firing on U.S. ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, the outlets that vigorously pushed the false story will not extend any new skepticism toward the official sources that sold it to them, nor will they offer any new respect or platform to the people like Max Blumenthal, like Boots Riley, who questioned the claim not weeks later, but in real time. Those official sources will still be central, and those asking questions or offering criticism will still be marginal. So for those who can't believe that the U.S. government is working with corporate media support to set up a false storyline to push the U.S. public to support another war on another country, might at this point ask themselves, if they were doing that, how would that look different than what we're seeing now? You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group FAIR. The March 11th Washington Post headline told readers that the Medicare for All bill, recently introduced by Washington Representative Pramila Jayapal, quote, reflects influence of hardline progressive groups, close quote.
not quite a hit piece, but something very like it. The article said a slew of groups further to the left shaped the bill, which would upend health coverage for tens of millions of Americans and cost many times more than the ACA. Which is why the Post claims, quote, to some progressives, this is a step or steps too far, close quote. Words like upend and drastically do their work. And at one point, advocates on the left are counterposed with most health policy experts. Supporters of the Jayapal bill insist there's a groundswell of grassroots enthusiasm for overhauling the country's health care, the piece says, without reference to any of various polls that would indicate precisely that. The thing is, public support for a fundamental change in the way we do health care persists, despite years of this sort of elite media treatment, perhaps because for most Americans, health care is not a partisan debate, but a crisis. Joining us now to talk about how Medicare for All would respond to that crisis is Diane Archer, founder and former president of the Medicare Rights Center. She is president of Just Care USA. She joins us now by phone from here in New York. Welcome to Counterspin, Diane Archer.
Glad to be here.
Well, can we start with just some basic information on Jayapal and more than 100 co-sponsors' Medicare for All Act? How, for instance, does it differ or is it different from the proposal Senator Bernie Sanders put forward last year?
It's quite similar to the Bernie Sanders bill. It is Medicare that we have today, only improved and expanded to everyone. And it's improved by giving people vision, hearing, dental, which is in the Sanders bill, as well as home and community-based care and nursing home care, which is at the moment not included in the Sanders bill. But otherwise, it's very much the same.
Well, we know that the major theme of much media coverage has been, how would we pay for it? And people have pointed out a number of problems with that framing, including its selective use. But it also reads like half a ball score, you know, Yankees 3, because you're not hearing compared to what? What's wrong with that way of putting things?
Well, a lot. We already spend more than Medicare for All would cost us. Right? We already pay too much for our health care. We pay twice as much per person as people in other wealthy countries. Our system is incredibly inefficient. There is hundreds of millions of dollars in administrative waste because of our commercial health insurance system, a lot of bureaucracy and profits that Medicare for All takes out of our system. And there's a lot of excessive pricing. Pharmaceuticals in particular cost twice as much here as they do in other countries. So just taking out the administrative waste and the waste excessive drug prices will save us so much money that even by conservative estimates, Medicare for All will cost us $2 trillion less over a 10-year period, covering everyone and expanding benefits. And, I should add, allowing people to see the doctors they want to see and use the hospitals they want to use anywhere in the country.
When it's presented as, well, we're going to transfer the cost of health care to the federal government, for a lot of people that just means, well, my taxes are going to go up, and so that's going to end up costing me more. But the math you're doing takes that into account as well.
Let's put it this way. Today, working people pay a bunch of money in premiums and out of pocket for their commercial health insurance, as do their employers. And that money would go, instead of to a commercial insurer, to the federal government. Only it would be a little less than what, on average, people are paying. Businesses would save and individuals would save. So instead of the money going to the commercial insurer, it would go to the federal government. It's that simple.
Well, the Washington Post, that piece I was citing, says that the Jayapal bill would overhaul the system so dramatically that summoning broad public support seems like a tall order. We can address that separately. But their point is, that's a big reason that some groups are proposing more modest coverage expansion, such as adding a Medicare-type public option plan to the marketplaces. What is the problem with what is presenting itself here and elsewhere as cooler heads prevailing, a more pragmatic approach?
I would argue that Medicare for some, as I call it, allowing some people to buy into some version of Medicare, is less pragmatic. We have a broken healthcare system, and we have two huge problems we need to address. We need to rein in the excessive costs we're paying for our healthcare, and we have to make sure that everybody in America can get the healthcare they need at a price they can afford. And Medicare for some does not address either of those two huge problems. Medicare for all, in fact, does. It reins in costs and it guarantees everybody in America health insurance. So Medicare for some is going to do very little to help the 29 million uninsured and the tens of millions more who are underinsured be able to afford their health care.
Yeah, it's not as though because it's a half measure, it would deliver half the benefit. But also, in reality, I would think that half measures really aren't, they aren't easier sells politically. I think it's mainly pundits who think that the center of the road and, you know, don't really disrupt anything, that that's always going to be the most persuasive argument to people.
Well, I think we also know from the studies that we have a majority of Republicans as well as Democrats who support Medicare for All. And the more they understand about Medicare for All, it seems the more they support it, right? The more they know that it involves the elimination of premiums and deductibles and coinsurance, that it adds important benefits that they, most people don't have today, like vision, hearing, dental, and long-term care. The more they see that it guarantees health care as a human right, the more support we have for it. And so I think a lot of this is helping people to understand what Medicare for All will do for them, and to understand as well that our commercial health care system will never be something that they can count on for affordable health care.
Yeah, I think that just knowing that if you or a family member got seriously ill or had an accident, that you would quite possibly lose every penny you have, you know, and many that you don't, I think that has a political impact. You know, like debt, it promotes a kind of caution and political quietude and even fear. And I can't help but think of all the energy that could be freed up if we took that worry from people, you know. But the insurance industry isn't going to go gently into that good night. They are spending millions on lobbying and PR. And research that FAIR did some years back showed a lot of interlock among the boards of media corporations and insurance and pharmaceutical companies. They literally work together. As we go forward and as things heat up, what should we be on the lookout for as we see coverage of Medicare for All? What sorts of key countervailing bits of information would you have us sort of keep in the front of our mind?
I think that the first and most important point is that Medicare for All is really not a new concept in this country. We've had Medicare now for over 50 years, and it works really well. People love it. People look forward to turning 65 and being able to count on Medicare because it does work so well, and that Medicare for All is only an extension of Medicare, a better version of Medicare, a less costly version of Medicare that will allow people to sleep well at night knowing that they don't have to be worried about the cost of their care. And I think increasingly Americans are seeing, if not themselves, the people around them struggling and making decisions no one should have to make between their health care and their kids' health care or their sister's health care. I mean, these are trade-offs that are unconscionable and unjust. Everybody in America should have the right to be able to see the doctors they need to see when they need to see them. And that is just not the case today. And that will never be the case with commercial health insurance.
Well, there are going to be, as they say, losers. You know, there will be people and industries on the short end of a change like this. And I think we just have to expect that they will be putting arguments out into the atmosphere that suggests that there's something very wrong or very dangerous going on here. You know, we sort of have to be, I guess, prepared for that kind of disinformation, right?
And what's wrong and dangerous is that there are so many people dying and suffering in this country, tens of thousands of people, because they can't get health care. And I think if people focused on the fact that this is going on to an unconscionable degree in the United States of America, the wealthiest country in the world, and other wealthy countries are able to deliver far better health care at half the cost, they'll realize that we can do it as well and that we can do it. And we don't need to rely on commercial insurance to get the health care we need. We can't rely on it because we can't get it through commercial health insurers.
Well, how can people get involved? I mean, we have legislation now to look at. Are there other things that folks can do to make themselves heard on this issue?
Always lots of things. Most importantly, they should be reaching out to their members of Congress. They should be asking for meetings, actually, with their representatives in Congress and telling them and sharing their stories with them about their struggles to get decent, affordable health care under our current system. It's broken, and they know it, and we all feel it, and it's unjust, and there is an easy solution. The infrastructure is in place to expand Medicare to everyone. We know Medicare works. It's tried and true. People love it. We just now have to move our politicians to hear us and to do right by us.
We've been speaking with Diane Archer, president of Just Care USA. Find their work online at justcareusa.org. Archer's piece, Why Medicare for Some is the Wrong Idea, can be found on thehill.com. Diane Archer, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you, Jenny.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website. That's FAIR.org. The website's also the place to sign up for FAIR's Action Alert Network or to subscribe to FAIR's newsletter, Extra. The show is engineered by Erica Rosado. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock this week. Check this out. Our first guest, a well-known Australian biologist, reacts to his findings on extinction.
That paper shocked me. Now, I get bad news every day. The world is in an extinction spiral right now. Environmental degradation is happening across the board. And I'm not just talking about climate change. I'm talking about deforestation and pollution and feral species, invasive species, the loss of insects. The list goes on. Climate change is a very strong stressor in a system that's already highly stressed. But when we did this paper, I had to sit back and go, wow, I did not expect it to be this bad. Now, there's even a scarier story in all this. To me, that just means that, you know, from these kinds of models and what we know about the fossil record, that we are pushing dangerously close to an extinction event that would, you know, certainly see our extinction, but probably most other species. Will life persist? Of course it will. Will there be species afterwards? Yes, but we might talk about millions of years of regeneration and speciation.
That is Dr. Corey Bradshaw, coming up in just a few seconds. Later, you hear a great new action song from Sweden, followed by an intimate chat with one of the foremost climate scientists in the world, Dr. Phil Jones, from the University of East Anglia in the UK. I'm Alex Smith. This is Free Climate Radio in a world running out of time. We are living in a time of mass extinction of species, large and small. How serious is that? What are the rules of extinction? Two scientists, Italian and Australian, investigated that. Their study, published in Nature November 2018, contains unpleasant surprises. Our guest is Dr. Corey Bradshaw. He is the Matthew Flinders Fellow in Global Ecology at Flinders University in South Australia. Corey has published at least 300 papers and 3 books. His latest is The Effective Scientist, A Handy Guide to a Successful Academic Career. That's published by Cambridge University Press in March 2018. From Adelaide, Corey Bradshaw, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
Looking over your past papers, extinction is not a new subject for you. What stimulated you and Giovanni Strona to investigate biological collapse in your recent paper?
There's actually an interesting story behind this paper that probably escaped most people's attention. So what happened was we were, you know, going through our normal sort of daily routines a couple of years ago and came across a paper that had just been published in the same journal, in fact, Scientific Reports, which is a Nature journal, that said that the Earth can take a lot of shocks. And yes, you might lose a lot of species, but there are a few species out there that are what we call extremophiles, and they can live in extreme environments that would kill most other beings. So you can think of things like the deep vent giant worms that grow on the bottom of the seafloor at sort of places like the Mid-Atlantic Ridge, or you can think about certain types of bacteria. But there's one species in particular that is, I guess, a bit notorious for its ability to be an extremophile, and those are tardigrades. The tardigrades are, for most people who might not know that word, the little water bears is a common name in English. They're more or less microscopic animals that tend to live in the soil. They're beautiful animals. They're bizarre-looking things. They kind of look cute and cuddly when you put them under a microscope. They don't really have a jaw. They have this sort of circular aperture that with teeth-like structures around it, and they have these little hook claws and a fat little squishy body. They're very cute. But what these things can do is they can desiccate, that is, dry out. They can be exposed to extreme heat or extreme cold. You can even shoot them into space, and they can survive. So the authors of this particular paper took these, what we call thermal tolerances, these temperature, the ability to withstand extreme temperatures, and tested what these tardigrades were able to do. And it's true, you can put them through all sorts of horrible conditions, and they can survive. So their conclusion was that the Earth could, you know, be hit by a meteor or go through a nuclear winter or heat up by, you know, 50 degrees, and you'd still have tardigrades around. Everything else would be gone, but tardigrades would still be around. Now, that's interesting if you look simply from the physiological perspective. But as an ecologist, and several of my colleagues, including Giovanni, said, well, this is a bit ridiculous because tardigrades don't live in a vacuum. They have to eat things and they have to survive within ecosystems, right? So we said, well, what would be the kinds of extinction rates that one might expect if we did what we should do is link all of the species together in what we call food webs, or these networks, these ecological networks. So who eats whom? Well, you can add more things than just the eating component. You can think of things like competition or pollination. So species depend on each other. Predators depend on their prey. Flowering plants depend on their pollinators, and so on and so forth. And so we basically decided to generate these virtual Earths, to use computers to, obviously it's a simplification to a certain extent because we can't model every species on the planet, but we did create virtual Earths that had the same kind of characteristics as ecosystems do today. And when we pushed the system towards a heating event or towards a cooling event, so the heating event's, you know, synonymous with things like climate change, or cooling could be something like an asteroid hitting us and going into kind of a nuclear winter scenario. When you did this, we looked at the extinction rates simply from species dropping off the perch as they exceeded these thermal tolerances, these thresholds of maximum or minimum temperature. And then we also looked at what the extinctions would be if the so-called extinction cascades were taken into account. So if you lose, for example, a prey species, then the predator would go extinct, and so on and so forth. And it had all sorts of issues about dispersal and adaptation and competition and so on and so forth. We also had latitudinal gradients like a real Earth. And we did thousands and thousands of these Earths in different iterations. When we did this, it turns out that the extinction rates, including the extinction cascades, actually were about 10 times higher than what you'd expect simply from the warming or the cooling.
And that key concept which you bring out in the paper is called co-extinction. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So co-extinction just means that if one thing goes extinct, there are going to be other things that depend on it that go extinct. So that's the co-extinction or the extinction cascade.
Right. And I think that in previous studies and in all of our minds, we think, well, we could just study the upper tolerance for heat by carrying some plant or animal inside and turning up the thermostat and seeing when they fail to reproduce or just die. But that isn't going to work because of the very reasons you just described.
Exactly. And, you know, it's pretty basic stuff, really, for ecologists. But for most other people don't actually consider those linkages. It did come a bit of a shock. But I'll tell you this right now. That paper shocked me. Now, I get bad news every day. The world is in an extinction spiral right now. Environmental degradation is happening across the board. And I'm not just talking about climate change. I'm talking about deforestation and pollution and feral species, invasive species, the loss of insects. The list goes on. Climate change is a very strong stressor in a system that's already highly stressed. But when we did this paper, I had to sit back and go, wow, I did not expect it to be this bad. Now, there's even a scarier story in all this. It's not just the fact that the extinction rates are probably 10 times underestimated if we just look at the thermal tolerances. If we take those networks now, and this is what we did also in the paper, and you deliberately pretend to be a super being and try to make the system go extinct as fast as possible. So what we did here was we just took the most important species in the network, which are generally the ones that are more connected in the network, so they influence more species. And we take the most connected node in this network, species, and we make that go extinct. Now, this is a computer experiment, obviously. This isn't in the real world. And then we take the second most important species, and we knock that out. And then we take the third most, and so on and so on, so forth. We can then compare that to a sort of a random extinction process where we just take nodes out at random, or we can then look at the extreme cold or the extreme warming scenarios. And as it turns out, the warming scenario mimicked almost exactly the worst-case scenario where we knocked out the most important species first. In other words, warming is pretty much the worst thing that can happen to an ecosystem. And that kind of follows what we've been finding. And I do a lot of paleo work as well, so looking at extinctions of mammoths and diprotodons in Australia and various things over the last, you know, several hundred thousand years. And what's coming out is it's not the cold events. It's the warm events that are causing extinctions, in addition to human stresses, of course. Usually it's a 1-2 punch. But unlike, you know, the the Ice Age films that I'm sure that most of us have seen or at least been forced to watch by our children or grandchildren. It's not the ice ages that cause extinctions. It's, in fact, the warming periods thereafter. And that's the really scary thing, because it's exactly the situation we're in now. Highly stressed planet already from human intervention and human endeavor that's rapidly heating. That is the perfect storm for extinctions.
So just to recap for listeners, rule one, during warming, the most ecologically important species go first. And rule two, global warming drives more species to extinction faster than global cooling. Are we good so far?
Yep, that's exactly right.
All right. Now, rule three, as I read it from your paper, is that during warming, plants tend to go extinct first. That seems counterintuitive. We're thinking, okay, the big animals are going to go first, but no?
Well, I mean, I'll ask your listeners to think about this. What's the one thing that plants generally can't do as well as animals?
Can't move.
Can't move. Yeah, exactly right. So because, I mean, they can disperse through, obviously through seed dispersal, and they can grow vegetatively and increase their distributions that way. But if things start to warm up, an animal just goes, well, this is uncomfortable. I'm going to move over there. And you can think about that over generational or even evolutionary timescales. Whereas a plant, it's a lot more restricted. Now, some plants are very good at that. Certain weedy species can disperse very quickly, and usually it's helped by an animal distributor. You know, for example, like a buzzy on a certain small plant can get stuck to the feathers of a bird, and it can fly a long way and distribute the species that way. But most plants really can't adapt that quickly. So if you get in a rapid warming scenario in particular, the local thermal tolerances are exceeded very quickly. And so what you get is an overall range contraction because they just can't keep pace with that change. If the change is really slow, and I think this is another thing people don't quite understand, is that it's not just the magnitude of the change, it's the pace of the change or the rate of the change that matters. And we're going through one of the most rapid warming events in the last 2.5 million years.
I graze Australian media, and I came across in the journal called The Conversation an article just published called An End to Endings, How to Stop More Australian Species Going Extinct. Are we losing a lot of creatures from that rare Australian ecosphere?
We are, unfortunately, the world leader in mammal extinctions. That is, we've had more extinctions in the last few hundred years than any other country in the world, for mammals, that is. We also have some of the highest declines in bird species, about 60% decline in total bird abundance over the last 50 years. We do have insect declines, but unfortunately not great data to show just how much. But, you know, we're seeing these extinction declines across the planet. Recent work from Germany and Puerto Rico has shown very disturbing declines in all sorts of insects. And these are, of course, the basis of the food web for most species. Birds eat them, reptiles eat them, and so on and so forth. So we're seeing a wholesale collapse of our ecosystems. And Australia is a kind of an extreme place already. Most of Australia is a desert, more or less. And we have this thin strip of vegetation sort of around the coasts. And we have a very delicate ecosystem. We've also lost almost more of our species over the last 50, 60,000 years than any other continent. We have very few large predators left. And we were on this knife edge. With increasing bushfires and droughts and cyclone intensity, as well as more and more development into very sensitive ecosystems, we're just kind of pushing all of that remaining wildness to the corners of the continent, and eventually it's all going to collapse.
And some of it just doesn't exist anywhere else. And we haven't even talked about marine extinction as more heat waves roll around the coast of Australia and around the world. Marine heat waves are a big new topic. Do your models include marine life, and does co-extinction play a strong role there?
It does indeed. In this particular set of models that we did, we didn't really treat the marine environment simply because we have a different kind of thermal dynamic going on. Obviously, the specific heating capacity of water is quite different. However, I'm involved in several other projects that are showing the massive changes in the marine environment. For one, we're seeing our algae communities, our what we call macrophytes, so those that tend to be like the big kelps and things like that. We've seen wholesale shifts in communities by several degrees latitude over the last 40 or 50 years, especially especially on the east coast of Australia, because that's a fairly the East Australia current is quite strong, and these pulses of warm water are coming down more frequently and descending more into the south. So essentially, the algae community off of the coast of Tasmania now is what used to be off the coast of Sydney 50 years ago. But I was just in Sydney last week, in fact, involved in another project looking at the tropicalization of the fish communities off of Sydney. So we were in lovely Manly, the very wealthy neighborhood, diving in this beautiful little bay, seeing large blue grouper and Maori wrasse and all sorts of things. But what was really interesting is we were diving, we were seeing these little sergeant fish, these things with the most wonderful genus name, Abu Deftaf, that are essentially from the Great Barrier Reef, thousands of kilometers north, and they're showing up every year more and more. There are now over 60 tropical species found in Sydney that were never found there before the early 2000s. And so this rapid shift is happening in some ways much more quickly in the marine environment because things displace a lot more quickly.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from Australia. My guest is Dr. Corey Bradshaw from the Global Ecology Laboratory at Flinders University. So, Corey, within that concept of coextinction, you portray different interdependent webs of life that help a lot of different creatures survive. But that interdependence also seems to offer a fragility that can bring the whole web down. Am I getting that right?
Yeah, so we ecologists often talk about things like functional redundancy. Now, that sounds like a fancy term, but essentially what it means is that there are different roles that different species play. For example, predators eat things, and plants photosynthesize, and certain things pollinate. And so everything has a specific role. Some things decompose dead flesh, and so on and so forth. So everything has a role, and there are certain species that do the same role. And we call this functionally redundant. I mean, every species has a slightly different niche. In other words, it exploits a slightly different component of its ecosystem. But that internal diversity and that functional redundancy is what gives ecosystems a certain shock-absorbing capacity. So they can take a disturbance and they can bounce back from it. Now, that only goes to a certain amount. So if you lose two or three species that have a similar functional role, the entire ecosystem can continue to function reasonably well. But the more species you lose from those functionally redundant roles, the more susceptible it becomes. And eventually, once the last species in that particular functional role goes, you can have a cascading effect right throughout the entire food web that affects almost everything else. So you can shock these systems, and that's an evolved trait as well. These systems evolve this capacity to withstand shocks because they've gone through them through evolutionary time. And the different components of these ecosystems shift in terms of what species are there at any particular time and over geological time, but the overall function is roughly the same. But if you push it too much, you get these mass extinction events. And we've had at least 6 mass extinction events in the past, probably more closer to 100 that we can measure through the fossil record. And it doesn't take a lot to push them. In fact, our model suggests that even a small change, well, small in the grand scheme of things, a 5-degree shift could see that most species in the world go extinct simply through this combination of exceeding the thermal tolerance as well as the extinction cascade. Now, that actually matches a lot of the sort of the order of magnitude temperature changes that we can infer from the fossil record for the great extinctions during the Permian and also probably the most infamous being the Cretaceous when the big asteroid hit the Earth and the dinosaurs went extinct. Well, no, sorry, they didn't go extinct. They turned into birds. But we lost the big ones. And so these wholesale planetary shifts are actually fairly easy to precipitate.
And you also say coextinctions are often triggered well before the complete loss of an entire species, so that even oscillations in the population size of a species could result in the local disappearance of other species. How would that work, and how do you know that?
Well, so looking at an entire ecosystem, we tend to simplify it to particular nodes where we don't take the overall abundance, for example, or the spatial distribution of a species into account. But I do a lot of population ecology as well, and one of the truisms of extinction is what we call the small versus the declining population paradigm. So as a population declines, and it can decline for a number of reasons. It can decline because people are exploiting it, or it can decline because of a disease. It can decline for a whole host of reasons. That process generally then turns them into small populations. Now, small populations are susceptible to events that wouldn't really make much difference to a large population. For example, there's a great example I always used like to give is the great auk. The great auk was, I guess, the Northern Hemisphere's version of a penguin. It was hunted for its eggs and its flesh through much of the last 500 years. And it was a, it's a large penguin-like looking bird. It could fly modestly, but not very well. And it was super abundant throughout much of the last 500 years, throughout most of the North Atlantic and parts of the Pacific. And because of its popularity for eggs and meat, it was systematically hunted down to small population sizes. Now, the last remaining population was on a little islet off the coast of Iceland, I think sort of near the end of the previous century. The dates I don't have exactly in my head. But this small population didn't go extinct. This was the last population. So the species didn't go extinct because of all of the hunting. That particular islet blew up in a volcanic eruption, and that was it for the species. Now, that volcanic eruption, had it happened when the species was abundant and distributed over a large area, wouldn't have made much of a difference. So you get different processes operating. These random or what we call stochastic factors become very important as populations get small, and you can get these wiped out entirely. Or if you have massive fragmentation in space, so you only have a little population here, a little population there, then a predator that, for example, that depends on those can't actually get to enough prey in time to be able to fulfill its own energy needs. And therefore, you can get, even though the extinction hasn't happened yet, it ceases to become, to do its functional role in the ecosystem, and therefore you get cascades well before the extinction.
But even if we don't get hit by an asteroid or a great chain of volcanoes doesn't explode, am I getting from your paper that there's some sort of limit around 5 degrees centigrade warming where there could be the beginning of a biological end, at least of the species that we know and can see?
Yeah, and that, I think that was one of the shocking parts of this, is that it doesn't actually take as much as you would think. Now, 5 degrees in a lot of ways is unfathomable for most people, but we're already sort of exceeding the 2, perhaps even 3 component with little chance of backtracking there or avoiding that. So 5 isn't really out of the realms of possibility in terms of over the next few centuries. Now, to me, that just means that, you know, from these kinds of models and what we know about the fossil record, that we are pushing dangerously close to an extinction event that would, you know, certainly see our extinction, but probably most other species. Will life persist? Of course it will. Will there be species afterwards? Yes. But we might talk about millions of years of regeneration and speciation. The Earth will go on until, of course, the sun does blow up or something, you know, more extreme that removes all life, but humans won't be around. And I think it's, you know, my colleague often says this, you know, the Earth will survive. Human society probably won't. And that's what scares me.
That's the direction we're heading now, but we could make an extreme turn, perhaps, and rework our energy system and so on. But you also discovered that scientists have had a kind of bias towards optimism because they left out this co-extinction factor.
Yeah, and, you know, as I said, most of my colleagues weren't terribly surprised by this paper, but they're ecologists. But when you talk to the average person and you paint that picture, just, you know, it's a lot worse than even the pessimists think. And I'm, you know, I've been in this job too long not to be a pessimist, but even when I can shock myself with my own work, I know that I'm onto something that's probably scarier than most people even care to appreciate. So it's, we're getting into not just the, okay, there's a problem. This is a serious problem, and it's much, much bigger than most people can possibly realize. And we're starting to get political momentum, you know, school strike for climate and Extinction Rebellion and various other movements, but it's not nearly enough and not fast enough. And you know, the human population isn't going to go away anytime soon in terms of our population growth over the next 100 years or so. So if anything, we're going to see more damage and more problems before it gets any better. I strongly suspect we're going to have to go through a major population crash before we have any capacity to be able to reverse or at least slow down some of these negative trends.
You're not the first scientist to tell me that on Radio EcoShock, but you do conclude that minimizing biodiversity loss is the best approach to preventing environmental collapse. Do we know how to save biodiversity?
Well, I think what we can do is probably, so the first thing is, of course, to do everything we can to limit the extent to which climate change is impacting the biosphere. But that's a political decision more than anything. I think in terms of smart management, this using models like these where we identify some of the most important species in those networks and putting more of our effort and our resources into saving those would be probably the smartest way to do it. So we're trying to maintain those strong functional roles within those ecosystems so that they can survive those shocks, those temperature shocks or those bushfire shocks or various other disturbances. So the more redundancy we have in the system, the more insurance we have. And that's, I think, what we have to focus on.
Mulling over your paper reminds me of that message so often printed on rearview mirrors. It says, objects may be closer than they appear, and it seems like the rules of extinction are almost hidden by the kind of consciousness that we have. We're very grasping. We think we know what's going on, but we don't. So I'm asking, did your study results stimulate new questions and concerns that you're now going to follow up on?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think a paper, most papers I write certainly generate more questions than they answer. That's just the reality of science. But yes, I'm certainly working on a lot of different kinds of network models now, both looking at past and future applications. So that's something that I've generated a lot of, you know, personal interest in. And I've got, you know, my entire lab is filled with people doing these sorts of things right now. So we're trying to get more of the complexity out of these systems just to identify which are the most important components that we need to keep around.
As we wrap up, tell us about your new science about the dingoes, the wild dogs of Australia.
Well, it's a paper that came out yesterday that just basically confirmed that the dingo is, in fact, a completely different species. It's in all respects, it's a native species of Australia and should be given protection because of it. But it's often considered just a wild dog that is vilified by especially the agricultural industry, and so it can be poisoned or shot or excluded with fencing. And we're just saying it deserves a very strong protection because it does play a very strong functional role in Australian ecosystems, and it needs to be protected if we want a chance of, again, increasing the resilience of the system. So that's generated a bit of controversy. I'm expecting to get some threats from people on email and online, but that's par for the course, really, in this business.
We've been speaking with Corey Bradshaw from the Global Ecology Lab at Flinders University in Australia. You can find links to all the science we've talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Corey, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Thank you very much for your interesting questions.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
This one goes out to planet Earth. Each one to each one.
Listen, listen, there's a distant sound.
Yeah.
Coming closer soon, it's all around.
It's all around.
Hear me, time is running out.
Come on.
Come on, tell them what it's all
yeah,
about.
Yeah, yes,
we're running
yes.
out of time, running out of air. Gotta keep it clean, show me you care. Wherever you are, you gotta wake up.
Come on.
We got a job to do, so stand up.
Yeah.
Salute life, not the general. Play fair, with your morals. We can be united as the nations,
as the nations.
For our planet, running out of patience.
Time, oh,
we ain't got no time. Come on.
We don't have time.
So we don't have no time now.
We don't have time.
So we don't have no time now. Yeah.
Time to act, we got a world to save.
Hey, hey.
Right or wrong now, as they used to say, more than ever, that is true today.
Listen,
you wanna be part of the solution? Switch it up for future generations. Level up, stop wasting.
Waste.
You wanna know if that's water that you're tasting? Stop playing with our future. My daughter told me if our planet dies, then how would you console
hey.
It? Show me some responsibility. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Hey.
That's right, y'all. We don't have time.
Kids don't usually do what you tell us to do. We do what you do. And since you adults don't give a damn about my future, I won't either.
Together we can do it.
We don't have time to wait.
Come on, let's go!
You just heard We Don't Have Time, written by Ingemar Betoni Aberg, C.J. Palmer, and Adam Batiste, with a little Greta Thunberg on the track. On Earth Day, this April 22nd, you can visit the new social network for saving the climate and truly making a difference. Get a sneak preview at wedonthavetime.org. Next up, Phil Jones.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
How do we know planet Earth really is warming? Well, partly because Dr. Phil D. Jones tracks temperature records from all over the world. Dr. Jones published hundreds of papers which are highly cited in climate science. For 20 years in the UK, he directed the Climatic Research Unit at the University of East Anglia. Now he is professorial fellow in the School of Environmental Sciences at the university. Phil Jones, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
You were awarded your doctorate in hydrology in 1977, and only 3 years later, you began your life's work of collecting temperature records from around the world. Why did you, as a young hydrologist, pick that up?
Well, at the time in 1977, when I finished my PhD, or just before even, I was looking for a job. And I had applied for a number of jobs in the hydrology area, but I also applied for one in the Climatic Research Unit and in at University of East Anglia in Norwich, and that was the one I got. And it was very fortuitous for me personally and for my career. It was a very good area to get into at that time.
And in your 2001 book, History and Climate, Memories of the Future, it surprised me to find that even up to the mid-1970s, shortly before you got on board, scientists thought that humans lived in a fairly fixed climate, you know, at least within our time frames. So even that recently, science had to shake off the medieval view of a never-ending stable cycle with minor variations. That seems strange to me now.
But there was a belief that climate, for all intents and purposes at that time, in around the late 1970s, 1980, could be thought of as constant. So we design things like river works in towns to stop flooding and dams to provide agriculture with water. We designed them assuming that the year-to-year variations in climate were pretty much the same, and you could just assume that that was going to continue into the future. But there had been studies earlier, and going back to Fourier in France in the 1830s, but more recently in the 1890s by Svante Arrhenius in Sweden, that if you increased the number of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, and carbon dioxide is the main one, then you would increase the temperature of the planet. And a number of people have worked on that during the 20th century. The first temperature record was produced by Vladimir Kirpin in the 1870s and 1880s. And another record was produced by Guy Stewart Callender in Britain in 1938 and 1961. And he also looked at the reason for the temperature increase that even he saw in his 1938 paper from the late 19th century. And he related that to carbon dioxide increases, and he also produced a record of carbon dioxide from measurements we'd made from expeditions to various places around the world of carbon dioxide concentrations from the late 19th century to about 1940, and he could see that it was going up. And that record is in pretty good agreement with the record that was later produced from ice cores in Greenland and the Antarctic of carbon dioxide trapped in the bubbles of ice. So Callender did some amazing work. And in terms of the temperature work, you've got to bear in mind that he did it all by hand. I mean, what we can do now with digitized data and computers is we can calculate things amazingly quickly. But I think Callender, it probably took Callender a couple of years to put all the temperature data together to show that the world had warmed from the late 19th century to about 1940.
Well, let's step back a bit. I mean, what is temperature? What is the thermometer actually measuring?
Well, the thermometer is measuring air temperature, is our main thing. You can obviously have thermometers measuring other things, like the temperature of the sea, the temperature in lakes, etc. What most people were interested in the first part of the 20th century, and even up to about 1980, was the temperature measured on land, which we refer to as air temperature, and it's measured in little sort of white housed little huts, not small huts. They're called Stevenson screens. So they're designed to protect the thermometer from the direct rays of the sun, but just to measure the temperature of the air. So this screen has a louvred shield around it, so the air can circulate and the thermometer can respond to the air and not to the direct rays of the sun. The idea is that if you get enough of these together around the world, you will put together a global picture. And a lot of people thought at the time, during the 20th century up to the 1960s, that this wasn't that important because they were more interested in forecasting the day-to-day changes in the weather rather than this longer-term aspects of climate.
And do we now have a standard time map of temperature, say, since the 1870s?
Yeah, we do, from about 1850, in fact. And we have a number of different components of this. So, as I mentioned, there's the air temperatures over the land. But we realized fairly early on when we started in about 1980 that the land is only 30% of the surface of the Earth. So 70% is oceans. And you need to include a number of measurements of sea temperatures as well, the proxy for air temperatures, because there's not enough islands around the world. There's vast areas of the oceans without islands. So in order to get a true global picture, you need to bring together air temperatures measured on land and sea temperatures measured in the ocean surface, called sea surface temperatures. And they then are a proxy for the air temperature over the ocean.
What are some of the tools used to reconstruct temperature records before the invention of the thermometer in the early 1700s?
Well, one other bit that's interesting is how the records were taken in the 17th and 18th centuries. They're mainly in Europe, and they gradually extended to other parts of the world with European colonization of places. So records in North America might begin in the late 18th century, and maybe where you are, they begin about 1850. But in other parts of the world, like Africa, they only begin in the late 19th century because there's just not enough measurements made, particularly in the interior of Africa, until that time. Most of the observations in Africa and South America were around the coast. And that's also the case in parts of India and Australia as well. So Europe is unique in having these long records going back to the late 17th century and into the 18th century.
Well, that brings me to my next question, because you investigated the concepts embodied in the terms medieval warm period and the Little Ice Age. Phil Jones, how important were those events, and are they part of climate change?
Well, if you look back in Europe, you can go back to about 1700 with a number of temperature series, but that's only 300 years to the year 2000. So what we thought and realized, it would be good to try and extend temperatures back in time. And we wanted to find various proxy sources that were capable of doing this. And there are a number. We might come to discuss some of these, like trees, coral records in the tropics, ice cores in Greenland and the Antarctic. And there are other records from lake sediments and sea sediments that can provide different measures of temperature. But the important thing to remember with these records is that they're biological with trees, and they're sort of biological as well with corals. And when the snow falls in Greenland, they're measuring some measure of the temperature then, but they're not equivalent to thermometers. They're not measuring temperature all the time. For example, trees are mainly responding to what happens in the summer months of the year, the spring and summer months, and they don't tell us anything about the winter months. And this is important because we know from the instrumental record for the last 150 years that, particularly in the Northern Hemisphere, because of its greater land area, the winters have a much more variable from winter to winter than our summers from one summer to the next. So we try to put together records of past temperature reconstructed from these various types of natural proxies. We also have other proxies, too, from where civilizations have written down things about the past. So these are mainly in Europe and China and Japan and Korea, where there's long written histories. So people can write things down about when rivers froze, when snow fell, how good the harvests were. And so they're year-to-year proxies in a comparable way to trees. But then they're all nowhere near as good as the instrumental data, which is telling you things about the days of the year, the months of the year, and not just one particular season. So when it comes to trying to piece all this together and look at the past, we really want to have records that can tell us things on the year-to-year timescale. And at the time of us doing some of this early work around the 1980 period, there had been concepts put forward about the pre-instrumental period. And one of these was the medieval period, say from about 950 AD to about 1250 or maybe 1300, was warmer than maybe later centuries. And that there was a period later from about 1550 to 1850 that was cooler than in the years in the 20th century. So the important thing to remember, though, is that these concepts came from work done in the 1960s or even earlier, when we had very little evidence about what was happening in the past. Now we have orders of magnitude more data than we had in the 1960s and 70s in terms of tree ring series, coral series, ice core series, documentary series, and the other proxies I've mentioned. So really, when we get all this extra data, the concepts we had of the past in the 1960s and 70s ought to gradually change with that new evidence. But even most paleoclimatologists who work with this data still use these terms, medieval warm period and little ice age, even though they're a bit pejorative in their terms, in that you obviously think the medieval warm period was somehow warmer and the little ice age was colder than some absolute level. But you've got to bear in mind that these records are not perfect like the instrumental data, and the medieval warm period appears to be a period in the medieval times which was relatively warm, but almost all the proxies are telling you things about the summer months of the year because it relates to crop yields, tree growth, etc. And the Little Ice Age is similar to some extent, but we do have a few more proxies for the winter months of the year from things like freezing of rivers and freezing of canals in the Netherlands that can give us a bit more of a clue to how winters varied in the past. So the medieval warm period and Little Ice Age are important periods, but I think they're overused, because people seem to believe that because they're mostly proxies of summer, they are somehow proxies of the annual average. And the instrumental record tells us that that is not always the case. There are periods, even in the period from 1850 onwards, when you have very warm summers and you might have colder winters at the same time. And so the annual average is going to combine those two particular types of signal.
What are some of the problems of constructing a good temperature record for China?
Well, we always thought that there was good, we know that there's good records in China. There's obviously the long documentary series that I was talking about earlier, and this does have records back for over 1,000 years, and a few places have records beyond that in the various dynastic records. And one of the things of using them is you've got to make sure that they are telling you, well, different people in different centuries are telling you the same thing about what they're measuring. So, for example, if they're measuring some yields of crops, it might be that the crop variety has changed slightly over time, and that is sort of hidden within those different observers who will have a typical human lifespan of maybe 50 years at that time. So what someone would say about the crop yield in the 13th century might be different from what someone would say in the 18th century. So you've got to bear in mind that although it might be good on the year-to-year timescale in terms of good years and bad years for harvests, it might be less good on the century timescale when you're looking at different centuries hundreds of years apart. And this is why the winter records of freezing of rivers, etc., are very good, because freezing occurs at a fixed temperature, 0 degrees Celsius. So we know that humans a long time ago would have noticed the same thing that humans would notice now if a particular river froze or a canal froze.
Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my special guest, Dr. Phil D. Jones from the University of East Anglia, where he directed the Climatic Research Unit for 20 years. Phil is an authority on temperature records. Well, let's return to Europe, Phil. Was there really a Dark Ages cold period back in, say, the years 500 or 600 AD? And was the primitive state of governments and culture in Europe during the Dark Ages perhaps a reflection of a climatic period?
Well, when we look back over Europe, we have obviously the long instrumental records, and this enables us to look at the proxy records in a much longer calibration period, if you think of it that way. So we can look at trees growing from 1750 to 1950, so 200 years of tracking the trees and tracking the temperatures, whereas in other parts of the world, that overlap is considerably shorter and generally less than about 100 years. So we have a number of long records, though, in Europe, and particularly in the more northern parts of Europe, where the trees are dominant in terms of they're providing reconstructions. It's not to say that trees in southern Europe don't provide reconstructions, but because it's warmer in the Mediterranean areas, the trees there are responding more to changes in moisture from year to year as the temperature is warm enough. Whereas in Scandinavia and northern Russia, the trees are responding to temperatures because that's the main limiting factor to their growth. Whereas in the Mediterranean, it's precipitation amounts. And we have a number of potential reconstructions from trees going back several millennia in northern Sweden and northern Finland, and also in northwestern Russia as well. And in looking at these many years ago, we noticed that there were, in the 6th century, there were two really narrow years in 536 and 542. And we believe that these are typical signature years from very cold temperatures during the summer, which come in Europe often after severe volcanic eruptions. For example, there's Krakatoa, and there's another big eruption in 1258 and 1601. So these years tend to lead to very cold summers in northern Europe. And in the 6th century, there were tended to be more volcanic eruptions in this century than in centuries before, if you go back towards the Roman times. And there were other eruptions in the 7th and 8th centuries as well. So when we're looking at this, you're looking at the factors that might influence the climate. So obviously one of those is the sun. The sun's output does vary. But also, if you have a large volcanic eruptions putting dust in the upper parts of the atmosphere, this then cools the surface and leads to these severe effects for 3 or 4 years after major volcanic eruptions. And so if you have more volcanic eruptions in certain centuries than others, then you will get sort of periods that appear cooler over a longer time frame of maybe 50 years to 100 years than other centuries which have hardly any volcanic eruptions. So this Dark Ages cold period is named because of it's in the Dark Ages period, which is the period after Rome collapsed in Italy and moved to Constantinople. But we believe that a number of major volcanic eruptions occurred in the 6th century, and there were a few more in the 7th century. This is why this period's become known as the Dark Ages cold period, because of these volcanic eruptions. And we can see more volcanic eruptions later during the Little Ice Age period, from about 1550 to 1850. And we can also see fewer volcanic eruptions during the medieval period, from about 950 to 1250. So maybe the medieval period was slightly warmer because there were fewer volcanic eruptions, and the Little Ice Age was cooler, and the Dark Ages cold period was also cooler because of more volcanic eruptions. But this is just one theory. We also know that solar output was potentially greater during the medieval period than it was in later centuries from some of the long reconstructions of solar output that have been speculatively produced.
Well, over the last 35 or more years, you've published over 400 papers, and you have a really global and wide-ranging nature to your research. In 2017, for example, you co-authored a paper on wildfires in Borneo. What is the difference, then, between a climatic drought and a hydrological drought? Aren't they both just caused by lack of rain or snow?
In principle, yes. But there's also a meteorological drought. There's another definition, which is the lack of rainfall for 30 or 40 days in Northern Europe. A lot of these definitions come from Northern Europe and maybe parts of North America, and they're less applicable in other parts of the world where you have a more climate in terms of in the tropics, particularly of rainy seasons and wet seasons. So in terms of a climate drought and a hydrological drought, these two are not that different, but they're also bringing into the mix the changes in evaporation as well. So drought isn't just the lack of precipitation. It's often exacerbated by the clear skies and the warm temperatures that go along with the lack of precipitation in many parts of the world. So if you combine the precipitation amounts and the evaporation amounts, then you get an idea of the sort of water balance, and that's more of a hydrological drought. And that's what we were doing in that paper in Borneo, is that when there's more hydrological droughts, when there's less rain and higher temperatures, then you have more potential fuel available on the ground to start fires in this part of the world, in Borneo, not deliberately, but by thunderstorms and lightning.
And some of those smoke fires were tremendous. They went as far as Malaysia in recent years, yes.
Some of the ones in recent years have, what the ones here in Borneo are more naturally started. But some of the smoke that went over Malaysia and Singapore from Indonesia are often from humans burning the forests to clear the forests of native vegetation in order to plant palm trees. So it's a clearance effect in Sumatra and maybe parts of Java as well.
Sadly, Phil, this year you had to help write a memoriam to your colleague Keith R. Briefa. Tell us about the man and why his work matters.
Well, this was a shock to me when he died a couple of years ago in October 2017, because I'd shared an office with him for 25 years, so you get to know someone very well in that sort of you're working together. Keith had been working principally on the tree rings, and he'd done a lot of initiatives in how to process tree ring data to ensure that you had this good year-to-year agreement between the trees, and you'd removed all the biological influences of growth trends. So trees, long-lived trees, do gradually put on smaller rings as the rings get more on the edge of the disc of a tree growth. And Keith was one of the main people who has written a number of key papers that are still used today by dendroclimatologists to look at trees. First of all, how well they agree with one another, then ensuring that they're principally looking at past temperatures or past precipitation events. And I think if you look at his papers, you'll find that virtually every tree ring paper written today will refer to two or three of his papers, because people are still using the concepts that he developed during the 1980s and 1990s and extended during his career until his untimely death in 2017.
And we also recently lost in February the American scientist Wallace Smith Broecker, the man credited with coining the term global warming, and he also established a great knowledge about the ocean conveyor belt. In his last message to scientists, a group of scientists at the University of Arizona, Wally Broecker called for more research quickly into geoengineering to shade the planet. Phil, do you think we're approaching such a dire need, and what do you think about it?
I met Wally a couple of times. He's a charming man, very very knowledgeable man. And I'm often asked about this same sort of question about the climate's changing and what are we going to do about it. And obviously the things we've got to do are to reduce the amounts of carbon dioxide and methane entering the atmosphere So we've got to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels and replace that with renewables and probably also nuclear power initially. But in terms of Wally's ideas about doing something more positive, doing something more...
Proactive. Let's call it proactive.
A proactive way in trying to cool the planet by putting enough sort of material in the upper atmosphere, sort of putting up there a sort of constant volcano to reduce the amount of radiation reaching the surface, which would cool the planet. Now, the problem with this idea is, in theory, it's a good thing, but we know from the volcanic examples that although the volcanoes go off in different parts of the world, and we're talking particularly here about tropical volcanoes, their effects are more global in scale, but they're not always in the same place, the effects, I mean, of where the cooling occurs. And I'm sure that if we started doing this, we probably would cool the planet down slowly. It's going to take a long time. But then you will have people saying that you have caused some different sorts of extremes in terms of droughts or floods or heat waves and cold spells, and that you've got to somehow, someone would have to take the blame for those. And is that the sort of science of the world or the governments of the world who initiated these schemes to try and cool the planet with a sort of continual volcano? It also assumes that we know fully what's going to happen in the future in terms of temperature change if we continue to burn fossil fuels. We know the temperature is going to go up, but do we know how much it's going to go up and go up where? It might go up much more in the polar regions, for example, than the tropics. But in order to look at this effect of trying to cool the planet proactively, I think we don't know enough in order to put that scheme forward and be confident with the outcome we're going to get. I mean, we have, in effect, had a sort of proactive experiment going on with the burning of fossil fuels, and we're now going to then try another proactive experiment with putting dust in the atmosphere to cool the planet. And I think we need to know more about the first one, which was inadvertent, before we go to the second one.
Many of us will not live to see the dangerous inheritance we leave to coming generations. In a strange way, I'm almost disappointed. I may not live to see climate science fully vindicated or society acting to save itself. Does that bother you, Phil Jones?
It doesn't bother me that much because I know that I'm 66, so I haven't got too many more years on this planet. But I know that my grandchildren have, and I know that my children and my grandchildren are going to have to take responsibility at some point for what we've done as a generation and what previous generations have done in increasing the average temperature of the world and making some areas less habitable than others. So I think there's going to have to be a lot of work done in the future, and it's got to be done in a competent way, like I was talking about earlier with the proactive ways, so that we really know what we're doing. We've got to follow it through with modeling studies, observational studies, etc., and we've got to be monitoring the planet continually in the future, improving our understanding of how the climate works so that we can then follow through in the models as to what we're doing and what is happening and whether it's going on with how we expected it to go on. But one thing I feel very interested about recently is that there's a number of groups in different parts of Europe and the Americas and Australia and maybe other countries where younger people are realizing that this is going to be a massive problem for them in their lifetimes. And these school strikes trying to raise interest amongst the politicians who have the ability to do something. So I think it's really positive with these children, and started by this Swedish child, it's really positive that they are going to push this agenda, and maybe the governments of the world will take notice. It's clear that some government leaders are taking no notice whatsoever and think they know everything. But I think there's going to be a few surprises along the way, and I wish I was 40 years younger and I could see more of it, like you were saying, but I'm not. But I think it's going to be a greater and greater interest amongst scientists in the future. And so I would recommend anyone who's of school age, that this is a fantastic career to have got into, that I got into inadvertently in 1977. And it's going to be a very important continuing career in future decades.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. From the University of East Anglia, we have been talking with Dr. Phil Jones, professorial fellow at the School of Environmental Sciences at the University of East Anglia. And as you can see from this interview, much more over his long career. Phil, thank you for sharing your time with us.
Okay, thank you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. A special hello to dozens of listeners from St. Hyacinth, Canada, and Wallingford, Connecticut, tuning in through Radio EcoShock SoundCloud page this week. If that's you, drop me a line. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. You can also listen to or download each and every new Radio EcoShock show, going back years if you want, absolutely free, posted every Wednesday at the show website, ecoshock.org. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening, learning, and loving this amazing planet. Join me again next week for more Radio EcoShock.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
It's hard to understand what they're thinking right now, but clearly they're in a state of kind of damage control, crisis management. You know, someone should do, you know, a remix of the Hitler movie Downfall, where they're in the bunker, but they're doing the voices of the Integrity Initiative.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, there's certainly a level of incompetence there. Again, it doesn't mean they're not being listened to, right? They could be complete idiots, but they could still have all these journalists. Well, mainstream journalists sort of sitting at their feet.
And so on that note, I mean, the journalists that speak to them are, I'm just amazed at the idiocy and the poor quality of these figures who are considered the like star reporters on Russiagate. I mean, they're almost as bad as like the New York Times Jerusalem Bureau. They're just so mediocre. And such a bunch of liars, and they're so unethical when they get caught making stuff up. Look at Luke Harding, who has just serially fabricated material about Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, and was finally fully exposed for just a bogus story on Julian Assange having several meetings with Paul Manafort, who is Trump's former campaign manager and is now in the clink. And The Guardian hasn't taken the story down. Mm-hmm. All they did was kind of edit it so they can pass muster if WikiLeaks takes them to court. Then you have McClatchy doing a piece on cell phone. According to U.S. officials, cell phone signals identified Michael Cohen, who is Trump's lawyer, in Prague at a certain time, which indicates that, you know, the Steele dossier was right and he was meeting with Russian spies or something. That appears to be totally false. The story's still up there. Everybody's moved on. And then most recently, you had this BuzzFeed story by Jason Leopold and Anthony Cormier. BuzzFeed, you know, they've written, I'm familiar with them because they've written so many bogus stories about me. But this one was just like fully false, basically claiming that it appears to be false, that Trump instructed Michael Cohen to lie about his dealings with Russian authorities regarding Trump Tower in Moscow. And it prompted Robert Mueller, who's normally considered the voice of God among Russiagate liberals, to actually issue a rare denial.
The walls are closing in!
He comes out and says it's not true. And then you see on Twitter all of these Russiagaters saying, well, wait a minute. It's not clear what he means by not true. It depends on what the meaning of not is. It could be, you know, he misspelled.
Or maybe his hands are tied because there's some big Russian conspiracy that has blackmail on him if he comes out and says that this evidence is actually there. So
that sounds like QAnon, you know, for liberals,
maybe. Mueller is compromised.
Right.
I mean, he actually did used to do work with Oleg Deripaska, who is just
sanctioned. Well, there you go.
So there it is. So. No, I think Mueller doesn't satisfy the Maddow the Maddow masses with his final report, they're going to start saying he's compromised. But, you know, my point is that, you know, these are false stories. They're still up. BuzzFeed's Ben Smith has instructed his staff to stand by the story. He said, we're sticking by this. And that's all you have to do in this day and age, is just stick by your story. And then everybody kind of forgets and moves on. The New York Times did a piece about these three stories with its media critic who, you know, is just, he's not really a media critic. He's like a mainstream media lackey. And he said that the reporters are in journalistic limbo. And that's what happens. You get to be put in journalistic limbo if you don't just take down the story and admit that you got the whole thing wrong. And they're all circling the wagons around this whole narrative that they've cooked up in tandem with the national security state, because they just can't step back from it. And that reminds me, and that's what the Integrity Initiative is going to do. I think they're going to just kind of pause and then move on to something else. But that reminds me a lot of, you know, Hasbara, which is to basically, first of all, pump out the big lie when something horrible happens. Remember Huda Ghalia? Her family was slaughtered on a beach in Gaza by Israeli naval shelling in 2006. There is video of her flinging herself on the dead bodies of her family. They were having a picnic. I actually got to work with the cameraman who filmed that in Gaza. Just kind of amazing to hear his account of what happened. I mean, he was a direct witness, and it was Israeli naval shelling. And Tzipi Livni, who I think was the foreign minister at the time, came out and said, well, they had fallen on a bomb that Hamas had placed on the beach.
Right.
And, you know, Livni just sticks to that. Michael Oren, I remember when he was on CNN and all over the media when during Cast Lead in 2008, 2009, he would say some of the same things. I think, he said that the Bakr boys, who were slaughtered almost on the same beach by, again, Israeli naval shelling or drone shelling, that they were actually killed, I think, by, you know, Hamas snipers.
Right.
They'll just say anything, and then they stick to it. And because they have a reputation in the U.S. of being this democracy with these serious figures who are taken seriously in Washington, they're not laughed out of town. They face no consequences. And then everybody just moves on. And a portion of the people who saw that come away believing their bullshit. They believe the Hasbara. And so it's like, if you're totally cynical, you can actually do some serious damage control in the media environment in the U.S. I'll point to another episode that's really fascinating that we're about to, we've done a piece on it by Dan Cohen at the Gray Zone, and we're coming out with a new piece today. Basically, there's this data firm called New Knowledge, which is run by these Democratic consultant hucksters who have been involved in a lot of the Russiagate initiatives to design like a Russian bot tracker, so we can say, oh, well, whenever like there's a hashtag going around that's inconvenient to the, you know, status quo, for example, take a knee with the NFL protests, we can say, oh, well, Russian bots are really pumping up this hashtag, so Russia must be behind this to divide us in our previously, racially harmonious society along racial lines. And these guys were hired by some Silicon Valley billionaires to go down to Alabama during the special election in 2017 between Judge Roy Moore, who's this theocratic accused, pedophile, grotesque gallery figure, going up against this centrist, basically moderate Republican Democrat, Doug Jones. And what they did was they ran what they called a Russian-style disinformation campaign against Roy Moore, where bots that spoke Cyrillic were purchased by the thousands and attached to Roy Moore's Twitter account. And then these consultants would go to their friends in the media, MSNBC, Mother Jones, and elsewhere, and say, Roy Moore is being boosted by Russia. And they made a lot of noise about that. It worked very successfully. They created a fake Facebook page to support a write-in candidate who is a Republican to peel away support from Roy Moore. And that candidate didn't even know that these hucksters were backing him, these data savvy consultants. Then they gave a presentation afterwards about what they had done, and they claimed credit for swinging the race to Doug Jones, who had won by 20,000 votes, which is a very small margin in a hotly contested race like this. And the presentation was at a, you know, Silicon Valley data firm's annual event. And on stage, alongside them, alongside this presentation about what they called Project Birmingham, which they openly called a false flag operation, was Scott Shane, who is the national security reporter for the New York Times, who's been their lead reporter on Russiagate. And Scott Shane gave a presentation on Russian and Soviet propaganda. And then he signed a non-disclosure agreement, basically legally forbidding him from reporting on certain elements of what took place there. Now, months went by. The midterms went by. Nobody talked about this. Nobody knew this was had happened except for Scott Shane, who is supposed to be informing the public about this. And then the Senate Intelligence Committee comes out with a report on Russian influence on a private Russian troll farm called the Internet Research Agency and how it played this role in flipping the 2016 election to Trump, which is just completely bogus. I mean, a bunch of fake Facebook ads had nothing to do with Donald Trump's election. And the fact is, according to Facebook data, 56% of those ads came out after the election. But here's the important point, if you can follow me here. That report for the Senate Intelligence Committee was written by the same Democratic Party data operatives who carried out Project Birmingham, who carried out what they called a false flag operation, which was a direct attack on American democracy in Alabama. And Scott Shane, the New York Times national security reporter, who knew about this, who knew about that report, I mean, who knew about that false flag black propaganda operation, came out with an article about how great the Senate Intelligence Committee report was and how important it was and how heroic the new knowledge firm was, without disclosing that he knew about this false flag operation they ran. Then weeks later, he finally dumped a report, which was a limited hangout, about the manipulation campaign in Alabama. But that, to me, really is the epitome of the dishonesty and, you know, complete lack of ethics of the press corps that's been covering Russiagate. Because here you have an operation in an American state directed against the American population to manipulate an election using what they call Russian-style tactics and a disinformation campaign. And it isn't a scandal. It isn't a scandal. Like the Integrity Initiative, it's only being talked about in social media. And you have a reporter, Scott Shane, from the newspaper of record, who has all of the details about it, and he signed a non-disclosure agreement so that we don't even know what he actually knows. What else could they be up to? What could they be doing now? We don't know. So it's really dismaying to me, as someone who's been a reporter, been in media, to learn about the extent of how much is being covered up and then how much disinformation is being pumped out at the same time.
This is a story that's coming out on the Gray Zone.
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to publish it in like 10 minutes. I just Excellent. Have to basically hit publish, but then I had to do this podcast. So.
Well, we'll look out for that, and I guess we should round up now. Well, thanks for coming on, Max, and listeners should visit the Gray Zone, grayzoneproject.com.
Yes, and thanks a lot for having me. Thanks for all the work you guys are doing.
I'm sure thanks, we'll Max. Have you all on again.
Absolutely. Yes. Well, Asa, I thought that was a really incredibly informative interview. What do you think?
Yeah, it was excellent. And I think we'll definitely be having Max on again. And there's there's a lot of topics to discuss. You know, Max has been a contributor to our website. You know, he's written for us in the past, not enough. Max, you should write for us more. the Lobby USA documentary, that Al Jazeera did a filmed and did a undercover investigation into the Israel lobby in the US. Max is something of an expert on that documentary, and his website greyzoneproject.com was one of the first, along with us, to start leaking segments of it. So Max is somebody that we work together with. So yeah, great guest.
Yeah, in fact, up on EI right now, there is a two-part video with Chris Hedges, the great Chris Hedges, who interviews Max and our own Ali Abunima about the Israel Lobby USA and its implications and what it reveals in terms of the reaches of the Israel Lobby, especially as it continues to suppress dissent, especially on U.S. college campuses. So check that out. We'll link to that on our podcast blog post, which you can find on electronicintifada.net. And with that, Asa, thanks again for another great episode. See you next time.
Thanks.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. Thanks to Sharif Zakout, our music maker and production assistant. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, support the Electronic Intifada by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sue Udry, Executive Director of the group Defending Rights in Dissent, who discusses documents that reveal U.S. government surveillance of immigration rights activists, lawyers, and journalists on the U.S. southern border and in New York City. Sonia Meyerson-Knox of Jewish Voice for Peace, who takes a critical look at the condemnation of Representative Ilhan Omar for alleged anti-Semitic statements, while calling out the hypocrisy of Donald Trump and Republicans for their use of racist, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic rhetoric. And Susan Burton, criminal justice reformer and founder of A New Way of Life, who talks about the residential program she's established for women returning from prison and the fight for incarcerated women. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Afghanistan has been hit hard by extreme weather in recent months. First, it was an intense drought that forced tens of thousands of villagers to flee their farms. Now, record flooding and snowfall have struck eight provinces, including Kandahar. United Nations humanitarian officials complain that European nations have not responded sufficiently to waves of hunger and human suffering in the war-ravaged nation. According to UN officials, 13 million Afghans were food insecure, and 3 million civilians were one step away from famine. A new appeal to international donors that called for over $600 million in humanitarian aid has been largely ignored by wealthy donor nations. Afghanistan has suffered the worst drought in recent years, resulting in the humanitarian crisis that has displaced 260,000 more people last year than the war between Afghan forces and the Taliban. The Norwegian Refugee Council reports that only a quarter of displaced Afghans have received aid supplies. The European Commission is providing an initial donation of 25 million euros to address the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, but said it may give more depending on future requirements. According to the Guardian newspaper, Afghans make up the largest group of asylum seekers traveling to Europe after those fleeing civil war in Syria. Women from the West African nation of Mali, who were victims of sexual violence, are pressing their case for justice and accountability before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Yet, according to the Christian Science Monitor, the ICC, under growing criticism from African leaders, has never successfully prosecuted a single case of gender-based violence. Maria Mingo Jaramillo, a legal and program officer for Women's Initiatives for Gender Justice, an advocacy group based in The Hague, says this move sends a message to both victims and perpetrators that the ICC is willing and able to prosecute if national courts are not. That applies to both Mali and beyond. Women in Mali became victims of sexual violence as Islamist rebels took over large areas of Mali, including the ancient city of Timbuktu. They were required to wear veils and were prohibited from being seen in public with men other than their husbands. Women who did not comply were often subject to imprisonment, beatings, and rape. The case before the ICC is giving women hope that those who perpetrated gender-based violence will one day be held accountable for their crimes. The Nation magazine reports that investigators from the Department of Homeland Security were closely monitoring anti-Trump protests and activists in New York City during the summer of 2018. Documents obtained by The Nation via a Freedom of Information Act request show that Homeland Security investigations, the investigative arm of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, transmitted detailed information about left liberal group protests to an undisclosed number of recipients, including at least one Department of Homeland Security supervisor. Among these was an email that contained a four-page document titled Anti-Trump Protest Spreadsheet 07-31-2018 that listed the time, date, location, and purpose of upcoming protests slated to take place around the city, including a Northern Manhattan rally against white supremacists organized by Congressman Adriano Espaillat that included groups such as Young Progressives of America, Refuse Fascism USA, and the New Sanctuary Coalition. Congressman Espaillat was outraged that his rally against Identity Europa, one of the extremist groups behind the neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, was on the Homeland Security spreadsheet. He wants to know whether Homeland Security or ICE surveilled or infiltrated the peaceful rally and why white supremacists were not on the watch list. Attorney Carolyn DeSell, a staff attorney at Columbia University's Knight First Amendment Institute, says the spreadsheet amounts to government surveillance of peaceful protests and threatens to chill protected First Amendment activity. We'll have additional information on government surveillance of immigration activists on the southern border later in this week's show. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
Documents obtained by a San Diego TV news investigation revealed that the U.S. government created a secret database of activists, journalists, and attorneys. The individuals listed include 10 journalists, 7 of whom are U.S. citizens, a U.S. attorney, and 48 people from the U.S. and other countries labeled as organizers or instigators. In some cases, American border officials working with the Mexican government placed alerts on individual passports. Those listed on the database were linked to a migrant caravan of refugees seeking asylum in the U.S., who traveled through Mexico to the U.S. border last fall, around the time of the American midterm election. Journalists who were assigned to cover the caravan for news outlets, as well as immigration rights activists and attorneys who offered to assist caravan members, said they had encountered harassment and intense inspections by both U.S. and Mexican border officials. Customs and Border Protection responded to the revelations by saying the surveillance program was a necessary response to assaults against Border Patrol agents in November 2018 and January this year at the San Ysidro border crossing. Elsewhere, a Nation magazine Freedom of Information Act request revealed another U.S. government surveillance database that monitored protests against Trump immigration policy and white supremacists in New York City, including one demonstration organized by New York Democratic Representative Adriano Espaillat. Your reporter spoke with Sue Udry, executive director of the group Defending Rights and Dissent, who examines the chilling effect government surveillance has on activists, journalists, and lawyers' protected First Amendment right to free speech.
The database was leaked to the NBC affiliate in San Diego, but we knew about the impacts of this database before we knew that there was hard evidence that there was a blacklist of people on the border. What's wonderful about this leak is that it's a document that substantiates that there was a program targeting specifically activists and journalists and lawyers and something called instigators in the documents. We knew it was happening, but now the plausible deniability is taken away because we see this list of 59 people, the bulk of whom are U.S. citizens, on this list that has stamped on the front. You can see on the document that it's an intelligence product of the Mexican and U.S. government working together.
Sue, can you give us some examples of what these individuals who are on this list experienced at the border?
It's a range of things. There were some people who, for example, a photojournalist who's a U.S. citizen who just kept being stopped at the border and then finally was denied entry into Mexico. A lawyer who kept getting shuttled into the secondary screening, which meant hours and hours of waiting to be able to cross the border. And then there's one activist who was interviewed by, I think, The Intercept, who said that he's a U.S. citizen living in Mexico, and he was supposed to go up to San Diego for a meeting of activist advocates who are working on U.S. policy, but he didn't go because he was just so frightened about what was going to happen at the border. Was he going to get shunted into secondary screening and have to, you know, wait for 8 hours? Some people were actually apparently deported from Mexico. So it's a range of things that were happening to these people who ended up on this list, whose passports were marked, and so who were subject to this more intense interrogation at the border.
Sue Udry, what is it your organization and other groups working to protect journalists and activists doing to push back on this collection of information about folks who are practicing their journalism or are activists when it comes to immigration policy? How can this be addressed? Through the courts, through the House of Representatives, now under control of the opposition party, the Democrats? What can be done?
I think that what needs to happen is systemic change, and it starts with, you know, Congress has all too happily handed over so many authorities to the executive branch, you know, just up and down the line from war powers to just very lenient guidelines and rules for federal law enforcement agencies, from the FBI to Customs and Border Protection. An argument can be made that what CBP did is not necessarily against any of the rules guiding them, and that's the problem, is that Congress needs to really instill some very strict rules that they've just not bothered to do. I would say that during the Bush administration, it was because there was still this heavy fear of 9/11 and not wanting that to happen again. And then under Obama, when the Democrats were in power, it was like, oh, Obama, he's fine. We don't need to worry about just the vast authorities that we've given to law enforcement and intelligence agencies. And now that Trump is in office, it's dawning on people that, oh, yeah, we really left the door wide open and now we've got to address it. So I was pleased to see that in the House and the Senate, there have been strong letters written to ICE and DHS about this, and that I think there will be hearings and there will be some more congressional oversight about what's going on. And so that's very good. It's great that this document came to light. So it gives Congress, it kind of shoves them into the realization that they've got to take some bold action.
That was Sue Udry, executive director of the group Defending Rights in Dissent. Find more analysis and commentary on U.S. government surveillance of immigration rights activists, lawyers, and journalists by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After newly elected Muslim member of Congress, Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, tweeted that American political leaders' support for Israel is all about the Benjamins on February 10th, she was attacked for what her detractors charge was anti-Semitism. During a subsequent talk and Q&A session at a Washington, D.C. bookstore, where she apologized for the remark, Omar asked why it's okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country and not talk about a powerful lobby that is influencing policy, a reference to the lobby group, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. That set off a new round of accusations from Republicans and fellow Democrats that Omar was repeating anti-Semitic tropes about Jews not being loyal to their nations. Again, the Congresswoman apologized, saying she had not intended her words to be interpreted the way many had heard them. A resolution was raised by the Democratic leadership in the House, initially to condemn anti-Semitism without singling out Omar, but then the language was broadened out to condemn all hateful expressions of intolerance. The measure passed overwhelmingly, with only 23 Republicans opposing it. Many progressives have come to the defense of Omar, arguing that it's fair to point out the influence of AIPAC and charge that the attacks are part of a broader campaign to smear a young Muslim congresswoman and suppress all criticism of Israel. Your reporter spoke with Sonia Meyerson-Knox, media program manager with the group Jewish Voice for Peace. Here she shares her views on the criticism of Representative Omar, while pointing out the hypocrisy of many Republicans and their president, Donald Trump, who regularly engage in hateful, racist, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic rhetoric.
Ilhan Omar has now twice been accused very publicly and with quite a lot of attention, including from Democratic Party leadership, of employing anti-Semitic tropes. And I think it's very important to actually look at what she said and what she tweeted. So the first time she tweeted a response to a tweet that Glenn Greenwald, the journalist from The Intercept, had put out, looking at the first bill that this current Senate passed, which would make the boycott, sanctions, and divestment movement for Palestinian human rights criminalize it, make it illegal in one way or another. And Ilhan Omar basically responded to that tweet by jokingly pulling a line from a Puff Daddy rap song saying, you know, it's all about the Benjamins. And when asked directly what that was referring to, she said AIPAC, meaning basically that she was implying that AIPAC, which is a very large and very successful lobby and which prides itself on being able to influence congressional politics such that there is a staunch support for Israel and increasingly not just for Israel, but for the Likud party, which is Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, his party in particular. That's what they pride themselves on doing, and they are not shy about that. None of that is anti-Semitic. Implying that Jewish people are using Jewish monies to specifically buy elections in corrupt, insidious, and backhanded secret ways, that is a long-standing anti-Semitic trope. But Ilhan Omar didn't refer to that trope. She didn't talk about Jews at all. She talked about AIPAC and its influence in terms of making America support Israel, which she criticizes based on its treatment for Palestinian human rights. There's nothing anti-Semitic there at all.
And then after the fury and the furor that developed from that, she then offered an incredibly heartfelt and I thought nuanced, detailed apology. And then continuing to speak about that experience a week or so later, 2 weeks later, she pointed out, talking about herself as a member of Congress, she was expected to have a dual loyalty, meaning that she was expected to not criticize the state of Israel. And again, that is not in any way anti-Semitic. Members of Congress are all the time expected to not criticize the United States and Israel's quote-unquote special relationship, which is a continued amount of support for the state of Israel. There are anti-Semitic tropes that go way back that accuse Jews of not being able to be trustworthy because they would have a secondary loyalty or a loyalty that supersedes to the state of Israel, such as Catholics often for a long time faced, and maybe still do face, racism and prejudice that they couldn't be loyal to America because they would hold the Pope in the first highest authority. That's anti-Semitism, or that's racism, and that's unacceptable. But Ilhan Omar didn't talk about Jews having dual loyalty. She talked about herself and members of Congress being expected to have dual loyalty. And in fact, when you look at who the most ardent supporters of Israel are right now, Michael Huckabee and Sarah Palin and whatnot, we're looking at Christian evangelical politicians. So increasingly, the idea that only Jews support Israel is obviously incorrect, as is the idea that all Jews support Israel is increasingly incorrect. And furthermore, therefore, criticizing Israel then cannot be anti-Semitic.
Sonia, I did want to ask you about the hypocrisy of some members of Congress, particularly Republicans, who have been cited over and over again for comments or tweets or campaign rhetoric that many have interpreted to be anti-Semitic, with very little focus from the media or other members of Congress being critical of those comments.
It's an incredible hypocrisy, and it absolutely reinforces the point that much of the criticism that Congresswoman Omar has been exposed to is based entirely upon the fact that she is Muslim and wears a hijab, and she's also Black. She's Somali. So we have racism, we have Islamophobia, we have, I think, also sexism and the general fear of a new rising powerful generation of politicians coming together. Meanwhile, we have the former House Minority Leader Ken McCarthy tweeted out about 7 months ago or so, accusing three different Jewish Democratic donors of buying the election, certain election results. Representative Jim Jordan more recently referred to a wealthy donor by name in a tweet and replaced the S in that donor's name with a dollar sign. These are absolutely anti-Semitic dog whistles. But we have even more explicit examples than that. We also have Trump himself engaging in quite a lot of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic tropes. He brought Sebastian Gorka and Steve Bannon onto his administration at various points. He retweeted incredibly anti-Semitic tropes about George Soros that have been circulating now for a number of years that really do employ all of the anti-Semitic stereotypes that we're used to seeing. George Soros' caricature was disfigured so that he had a hook nose and he had big eyebrows and he was clutching bags of money. I mean, this is unacceptable behavior. And it's targeting a person, an individual, George Soros himself. And Trump retweeted that. When neo-Nazis carried tiki torches through Charlottesville and chanted, "Jews will not replace us," we were told by the president that some very fine people were there, and that behavior was not in any way criticized or condemned. So we are seeing anti-Semitism at the highest reaches of the United States government, and then we see it, of course, finally manifest in, you know, the killing of 11 Jewish people in the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And yet these are the people, and this is the party that demands that everybody else that criticizes Israel is automatically anti-Semitic. It's absolutely absurd and reprehensible and speaks to nothing more than the extent to which what we're seeing now with Ilhan Omar is really all about Islamophobia, racism, and the attempt to silence any criticism of Israel.
That was Sonia Meyerson-Knox, media program manager with the group Jewish Voice for Peace. Find more perspectives on the controversy surrounding Representative Omar's comments on Israel by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In celebration of International Women's Day on March 8th, a woman spoke to a large crowd in New Haven, Connecticut, about women who are usually not celebrated at all, those who are incarcerated and struggling to recover from drug and alcohol addiction. Susan Burton, like a great many incarcerated women, grew up poor, suffered sexual abuse as a child, was raped as a teen, bore a daughter, and then lost all hope when another child, a 5-year-old son, was run over accidentally killed by police. After spiraling into addiction and being incarcerated 6 times, she finally found a recovery program that worked for her and successfully completed it more than 20 years ago. Burton then began establishing homes for other women coming home from prison with a range of support services. She now has 7 such homes in the Los Angeles area. Burton's program is called A New Way of Life, and her new memoir is titled Becoming Ms. Burton, From Prison to Recovery to Leading the Fight for Incarcerated Women. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded her talk at Gateway Community College, which was sponsored by the Connecticut Women's Consortium. Here, Burton begins by talking about the struggles in her early life.
I was, you know, learning how to get through with the least harm as possible and negotiating one trauma for the next, you know, what was going to be more bearable. And that's the story of many, many, many of the women. I'll say 80% of the women that come through A New Way of Life, you know, we talk about and work through and try to understand what happened early on that affects the way we are responding today. That's the story of women all over this country who have responded to their treatment, their environment, in ways that this country finds unacceptable and locks them up. And locks them up and spends hundreds of thousands of dollars each year to incarcerate them and then spend them back out into our community more harmed than when they went in.
Burton eventually got into a 100-day residential treatment center.
And what I discovered, you know, it was a upscale community. It was Santa Monica. It was by the beach. There was so much there. But what I found for me, for the first time in my life, I felt safe. And there was compassion there. There was empathy there. There was food there. There was clothing there. There was regularity. And I got introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the other thing that I discovered there is that people in Santa Monica didn't go to prison for drugs. What is this? They get a court card. They get deferred to treatment. They get, you know, community service. And all of those times, 6 times, I was sentenced to prison for possession of drugs. And I'm thinking, nobody felt that they could invest in me. I wasn't worth an investment. You know, what's wrong, you know, with this society? And I began to heal, and I began to get stronger. I eventually went back to school, but I began to think about how hard my life had been and how it could have and it should have been different had anyone thought enough to just make a simple investment. You know, I can remember walking in the courtroom and telling the judge about my son and what had happened and that I needed help. And that judge sentenced me to prison. And I was stripped of everything, my identity, my individuality, my dignity, my purpose, any dreams, any hope. It was just gone. But in Santa Monica, it was altogether different. And so I saved a few dollars, went to work as a caregiver, and bought a little house. And I would go down to the bus station in Skid Row, downtown L.A., where women get off, where we get off the bus and try to make a life. And I'd meet my friends, and I'd offer them a bed, a safe place, and that started A New Way of Life Reentry Project. To date, more than 1,000 women have been through those homes. There's 7 homes. You know, we have all types of services and legal services. We have a legal department, organizing department, leadership department.
After her book came out, world-renowned architect Frank Gehry invited her to do a project on the architecture of prisons.
And I got to go to Finland, and I got to go to Norway, and I got to go to Lisbon, And I got to see what other countries do. And what I came back with is that this country is intentionally barbaric. And yes, yes, they're intentionally, from the way they structure the prison, the whole thing is made to harm people. And it's intentional. And that we as a nation has this deep-seated need for revenge.
That was Susan Burton, criminal justice reformer and founder of A New Way of Life, speaking in New Haven, Connecticut, at an International Women's Day event on March 8th. Learn more about Burton's residential program for women returning from prison by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Manafort rises. Much of the nation waited with bated breath on the imminent sentencing of Paul Manafort, the once powerful operator of a foreign representation firm and ally of an American president. According to the pundits clogging cable news channels, Mr. Manafort faced a daunting prison sentence of nearly a quarter of a century. And then a federal judge lifted his gavel and pronounced he was giving him 4 years and the reign of money, power, and social position became clearer to see. He had, the judge said, lived a relatively blameless life, so the sentence lightened and lifted from his shoulders. As a man in prison, far be it from me to recommend harsh or heavy prison sentences. That's not my bag. But we are clearly in the unholy grip of the greatest imprisonment fever the world has ever seen. We're in the midst of mass incarceration, and those who come from the other side of the tracks, they find very little possibility of felicitous judges, light sentences, or whispers of mercy. Paul Manafort, after all, is one of the guys, one of the big boys, wealthy, tanned, and entitled by birth to breaks that the poor cannot even dream of. That's just the way it is. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. PLS is supposed to provide civil legal services to indigent prisoners in New York State prisons in cases where no other counsel was available. When PLS first began, it was a very progressive legal services organization that protected the rights of prisoners and kept docs honest by holding prison guards and administrators accountable. This was good for everyone involved. PLS back then forced the state to make docs more efficient and effective by keeping abusive, sadistic, and unprofessional prison guards in check and by exposing corrupt and incompetent prison administrators. Taxpayers saved money because prison guards and administrators were more conscious about the potential for lawsuits filed by PLS on behalf of prisoners. But in the early 90s, the Prison Litigation Reform Act
and other measures were passed, making it harder for lawyers of prisoners to recover attorney fees for successfully proving a case against prison guards and administrators. This created a disincentive for private lawyers to take prison civil cases pro bono. This increased the demand on PLS, which was heavily funded by the state government. Then, Pataki came to office and slashed funding to PLS. Instead of fighting back and seeking innovative ways to finance themselves, PLS became complacent. I think this had much to do with the fact many progressives back in the 60s and 70s that ended up founding organizations like PLS were so liberal they didn't pay attention to the bottom line nor to the growing propaganda campaign of conservative elements that turned the public hostile towards progressive programs. So, pseudo-progressive lawyers who are nothing more than either capitulationists or opportunists have taken over PLS. They're just making a buck off of us prisoners doing the least amount possible. In my 22 years of incarceration, PLS has never once taken any of my cases. In fact, they once led me to believe they would assist me in a matter only to wait until the last minute for me to file an action to tell me they didn't find any issue worth pursuing. So, I was forced to scramble and file the matter myself. Ironically, I won, which begs the question, what was I able to see that these so-called trained lawyers couldn't? I questioned several old-school prisoners who have told me similar stories. Most, when asked, will tell you PLS is, quote, full of shit, end quote. It is my belief that PLS is a fraud. They're using the struggle of us prisoners to scam the state government and private foundations for grant money, but they aren't doing shit for us except the barest minimum. I can't even get their help to fight doctors' clearly unreasonable decision to deny my request for approval to form a prison chapter of my USD organization, which I use to positively organize, motivate, inspire, and educate young prisoners and to steer them away from gangs, drugs, and violence. USD will help lower prison recidivism and decrease prison violence, saving New York State money, but PLS won't lift a finger to help me. I'm going to be reporting more extensively on PLS. I believe it needs to be overhauled completely or abolished. I have a few good ideas on how to make PLS better, but I'm going to keep them to myself for now. First, we have to expose it for the fraud that it is. This is Dante S. Mitchell, better known as Infilemaker Kibu, reporting to you from Great Meadow Correctional Facility in Comstock, New York. Follow me on Facebook at Free Dante Mitchell. Thank you for listening, and God bless.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
How successfully have authorities contained the threats associated with the 8-year-old Fukushima Daiichi nuclear meltdowns? How reliable are Japanese government claims that the country will be safe for next year's Olympic Games? Is there documented evidence that health authorities knowingly misled the Japanese people about the health threat coming from the meltdowns? Are there parallels between responses to the Fukushima disaster and those to the 40-year-old Three Mile Island disaster? On a week marking the 8th anniversary of the earthquake and triple nuclear meltdown of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility, the Global Research News Hour provides analysis and commentary with experts who have been following the impacts and the ways in which regulatory, government, and other agencies have responded. Our first guest, Dr. Helen Caldicott, brings us up to speed on the likely repercussions to human health flowing from the disaster. In our second half hour, Arnie Gunderson addressed the flaws in radiation monitoring and the cover-ups that protect the industry. On this week's program, Fukushima at 8, ongoing cover-up of the nuclear hazards in Japan and abroad. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 15th, 2019. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe Gakin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the historical territory of the Nahiwak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. If the intervention now being prepared for is not halted, there will be dramatic consequences for the people of Venezuela, for the entire continent, and internationally. The Latin American governments who are allied with Washington against Venezuela are ultra-reactionary. The very names of heads of state such as Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Mauricio Macri in Argentina, Iván Duque in Colombia, Jimmy Morales in Guatemala, Martin Vizcarra in Peru, Juan Carlos Varela in Panama, and Sebastián Piñera in Chile are synonymous with reactionism. And of course, the European powers in a parade led by France, Germany, and UK and Spain. The UK and Spain, fearful that they might miss an opportunity to get a piece of Venezuela's natural wealth, have rushed to get in line behind the United States and recognize Guaido. The former colonial powers must be denounced for conducting such policies while at the same time not hesitating for a moment to lend their support to true dictatorships like that of Abdel Fattah el-Sisi in Egypt, Idris Deby in Chad, and Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia, who is killing the people of Yemen and had an opposition journalist literally butchered in his embassy in Istanbul. That comes from the article, Venezuela, Suspend Debt Repayments and Create an Emergency Humanitarian Fund, by Eric Toussaint, posted March 13th, originally published at the site of the Committee for the Abolition of Illegitimate Debt. The Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, which designed the Canada Infrastructure Bank, has predicted a global water market worth $1 trillion by 2020. Obviously, SNC-Lavalin wants to be in on all that MCS hydroelectric development and other projects to be financed by Trudeau's Canada Infrastructure Bank in the coming years. But if they have to face prosecution, the company risks being barred from federal contracts for 10 years. The Trudeau government says it is attempting to protect SNC-Lavalin jobs. That may be true, but it is also likely that the Trudeau government is attempting to protect its long-term vision for Canada, a vision that jettisons reconciliation and the environment in favor of damming the country and then draining it. That comes from the article, Canada's SNC-Lavalin Affair, the Site C Dam Project and Bulk Water Export, by Joyce Nelson, posted March 13th. According to a report examining the Iron Dome project, the United States has already provided at least $5.5 billion of the development costs of the system since it was first proposed in 2010. In 2018, Congress provided an additional $705 million to the Israeli government for various missile defense projects, which included Iron Dome. That means that Washington is buying back a system that it paid to develop and is therefore paying for it twice. This is a wonderful way to do business for Israel, but it is a complete ripoff of the American taxpayer. The fact that no one in Congress is complaining is perhaps attributable to the willingness of the government to do favors for Israel, including favors that undercut the U.S.'s own defense industries, as Israel will undoubtedly use reports of the sale to boost its own efforts to market the product worldwide. That comes from the article, Buying Back the Iron Dome from Israel. U.S. taxpayers are being ripped off as U.S. Army buys back what we paid to develop, by Philip Giraldi, posted March 13th, originally published on American Free Press. When it comes to safety in the aviation industry, powerful players tend to monetize rather than humanize their passengers. A company like Boeing is seen as much as a patriot of the U.S. defense industry as a producer of passenger aircraft. The company's presence in Washington is multiple and vast, characterized by the buzzing activity of some 24 in-house lobbyists and 20 lobbying firms. Lobbyists such as John Keast, a former principal at Cornerstone Government Affairs, have links with lawmakers such as Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, nurtured since the days he was chief of staff. Wicker spokeswoman, Brianna Manzelli, was, however, keen to narrow that influence supposedly wielded by Keast in a statement made to CNN. That comes from the article, Boeing's 737 MAX 8, Lobbies and Belated Groundings, by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted March 14th. The CIA is conspiring with ISIS commanders in northeastern Syria, supplying them with fake documents and then transferring them to Iraq, according to reports in Turkish pro-government media. About 2,000 ISIS members were questioned in the areas of Kesra, Busera, Al-Omar, and Suwayr in Deir Azor province, and at least 140 of them then received fake documents. Some of the questioned terrorists were then moved to the camps of Al-Hol, Hasaka, and Rukban, which are controlled by U.S.-backed forces. The CIA also reportedly created a special facility near Abu Kashab with the same purpose. Israeli, French, and British special services are reportedly involved. That comes from the article under the headline, Video: CIA is Turning Refugee Camps in Eastern Syria into ISIS Hotbeds, Turkish Media Reports. Posted March 14th, originally published at South Front. Institutions within capitalist countries, including government ministries, defense forces, intelligence agencies, judiciary, universities, and representative bodies, recognize to varying degrees that the overriding demands of transnational capital spill beyond the boundaries of nation states. The resulting worldwide reach motivates a new form of global imperialism that is evident by coalitions of core capitalist nations engaged in past and present regime change efforts via sanctions, covert actions, co-options, and war with non-cooperating nations. Iran, Iraq, Syria, Libya, Venezuela, Cuba, North Korea, and Russia. The attempted coup in Venezuela shows the alignment of transnational capital supporting states in recognizing the elite forces that oppose Maduro's socialist presidency. A new global imperialism is at work here, whereby Venezuela's sovereignty is openly undermined by a capital imperial world order that seeks not just control of Venezuela's oil, but a full opportunity for widespread investments through a new regime. The widespread corporate media negation of the democratically elected president of Venezuela demonstrates that these media are owned and controlled by ideologists for the global power elite. That comes from the article, Wealth Concentration Drives A New Global Imperialism, by Peter Phillips, posted March 14th. Policies accelerating debt-based income transfer since 2001 have been expanding and deepening since 2000 across both Republican and Democrat regimes, from Bush through Obama, now accelerating even faster under Trump. For consumer and household debt, clearly the working class middle class pays most of the interest on the debt via mortgage, auto, student, and credit cards, rising state and local taxation, more federal taxation paying for the Trump tax cuts, etc. The federal government and thus the taxpayer pay the interest on the government bond debt. The creditors and owners of the debt reap the benefits, now in the trillions of dollars annually. The Trump budget proposes to pay for the U.S. government's share of the total debt by transferring the cost of financing military defense spending and tax cutting, which creates more deficit and debt to those households who aren't investors and business owners. That comes from the article, Trump's $34 trillion deficit and debt bomb, by Dr. Jack Rasmus, posted March 14th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. It was on Friday, March 11th, 2011, that a magnitude 9.0-9.1 earthquake led to a tsunami which devastated the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear facility. The event resulted in 16,000 deaths, causing some 165,000 people to flee their homes in the Fukushima area. Radioactive material is known to have entered the atmosphere in plumes spreading across the Pacific and into North America. Radioactive water was and continues to be dumped into the Pacific Ocean, creating an ongoing radiative hazard. As reported on the Global Research NewsHour, authorities have underplayed the damage and radiological contamination which resulted. On the 8th anniversary of the disaster, we get updates from two prominent experts who've been debunking much of the statements by the Japanese government and health authorities. We start with well-known anti-nuclear campaigner, Dr. Helen Caldicott. Well, I'm joined right now by a past guest. Dr. Helen Caldicott has been an author, physician, and one of the world's leading anti-nuclear campaigners. She helped to reinvigorate the group Physicians for Social Responsibility, acting as president from 1978 to 1983. Since its founding in 2001, she served as president of the U.S.-based Nuclear Policy Research Institute, later called Beyond Nuclear, which initiates symposia and educational projects aimed at informing the public about the dangers of nuclear power, nuclear weapons, and nuclear war.
And she is the editor of the 2014 book, Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of the Fukushima Nuclear Catastrophe. She joins us now on a week marking the 8th anniversary of the Fukushima disaster. It's great to have you back on the show, Dr. Caldicott.
Thank you.
Now, the Japanese government is preparing to welcome visitors to Japan for the 2020 Olympic Games, and coverage of the 8th anniversary of the Fukushima disaster is hardly, it seems to me, registered given the significant radiological and other dangers that you cited and your authors cited in your 2014 book, Crisis Without End. Now, it's been more than 4 years since that book came out. I was hoping you could update our listenership on what is currently being recognized as the main health threats in 2019, perhaps not registered in the book that you're currently looking at in relation to the Fukushima meltdowns.
Well, it's difficult because the Japanese government has authorized really only examination of thyroid cancer. Now, thyroid cancer is caused by radioactive iodine, and there are many, many cases of that after Chernobyl. And already they've looked at children under the age of 18 in the Fukushima prefecture at the time of the accident. And how many children? 2001, by June 18th of last year, 2001, had developed thyroid cancer. Some cancers had metastasized. The incidence of thyroid cancer in that population normally is 1 per million. So obviously there's an epidemic of thyroid cancer, and it's just starting now. What people need to understand is the latent period of carcinogenesis, i.e. the time after exposure to radiation when cancers develop is any time from 3 years to 80 years. And so it's a very, very long period. Thyroid cancers appear early. Leukemia appears about 5 to 10 years later. They're not looking for leukemia. Solid cancers of every organ or any organ start to appear about 15 years later and continue. And in fact, the Hibakusha from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, who are still alive, are still developing cancers in higher than normal numbers. The Japanese government has told doctors that they're not to talk to their patients about radiation and illnesses derived thereof. And in fact, if the doctors do that, they might lose their funding from the government. The IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, interestingly set up a hospital, a cancer hospital in Fukushima, along with the Fukushima University for people with cancer, which tells you everything. So there's a huge, huge cover-up. I have been to Japan twice, and particularly to Fukushima, and spoken to people there, and the parents are desperate to hear the truth, even if it's not good truth. And they thank me for telling them the truth. So it's an absolute medical catastrophe, I would say, and a total cover-up to protect the nuclear industry and all its ramifications.
Mm. Now, are we talking about some of the contamination that happened 8 years ago, or are we talking about ongoing emissions from, for example,
well,
the water?
Well, there are ongoing emissions into the air consistently, number one. Number two, a huge amount of water is being stored, over 1 million gallons, in tanks at the site. That water is being siphoned off from the reactor cores, the damaged, melted cores. Water is pumped consistently every day, every hour, to keep the cores cool in case they have another melt. And that water, of course, is extremely contaminated. Now, they say they've filtered out the contaminants except for tritium, which is part of the water molecule, but they haven't. There's strontium, cesium, and many other elements in that water. It's highly radioactive. And because there isn't enough room to build more tanks, they're talking about emptying all that water into the Pacific Ocean, and the fishermen are very, very upset. The fish already being caught off Fukushima, some are obviously are contaminated, but this will be a disaster. Water comes down from the mountains behind the reactors, flows underneath the reactors into the sea, and always has. And when the reactors were in good shape, the water was fine, didn't get contaminated. But now the three molten cores are in contact with that water flowing under the reactors, and so the water flowing into the Pacific is very radioactive, and that's a separate thing from the million gallons or more in those tanks. They put up a refrigerated wall of frozen dirt around the reactors to prevent that water from the mountains flowing underneath the reactors, which has cut down the amount of water flowing per day from 500 tons to about 150. But of course, if they lose electricity, that refrigeration system is going to fail, and it's a transient thing anyway. So it's ridiculous. Over time, the Pacific is going to become more and more radioactive. They talk about decommissioning and removing those molten cores. When robots go in and try and have a look at them, their wiring just melts and disappears. They're extraordinarily radioactive. No human can go near them because they would die within 48 hours from the radiation exposure. They will never, and I quote, never decommission those reactors. They will never be able to stop the water coming down from the mountains. And so, the truth be known, it's an ongoing global radiological catastrophe, which no one really is addressing in full.
Mm. Do we have a better reading, like, for example, with the thyroids, but also leukemia, incubation?
No, they're not looking – well, leukemia, they're not looking for leukemia.
Just thyroid.
They're not charting it. So the only cancer they're looking at is thyroid cancer, and that's really high, 201 have already been diagnosed, and some have metastasized. A very tight lid is being kept on any other sort of radiation-related illnesses, all other cancers and the like, and leukemia. So it's it's not just a catastrophe. It's
a cover-up.
Yeah, it's just I can't really explain how I feel medically about it. It's just hideous.
Well, I have a brother who's a physician, and he was pointing to, well, we should maybe – the World Health Organization is a fairly authoritative body of research for all of the indicators and the epidemiological aspects of this. But you seem to suggest that World Health Organizations may not be that reliable in light of the fact that they've partnered with the IAEA. Is that my
correct
understanding?
They signed a document, I think in 59, that with the IAEA that they would not report any medical effects of radiological disasters, and they've stuck to that. So they are in effect in this area part of the International Atomic Energy Agency, whose mission is to promote nuclear power. So don't even think about the WHO. It's really obscene.
Mm. So, I mean, what the incentive would be simply that they got funding, or how did that – what is
the incentive? I don't know.
No,
I really don't know, but they've sold their soul to the devil.
That's pretty incredible. So there's also the issue of biomagnification in the oceans, where you have the radioactive degree, hundreds of tons of this radioactive water getting into the oceans and biomagnifying up through the food chain, so these radioactive particles can get inside our bodies. And could you speak to what you anticipate to see, what you would anticipate, whether it's recorded by World Health authorities or not, what we could expect to see in the years ahead in terms of the illnesses that manifest themselves?
Well, number one, Fukushima is a very agricultural prefecture. Beautiful, beautiful peaches and beautiful food and lots of rice. And the radiation spread far and wide through the Fukushima prefecture, and indeed they've been ploughing up millions and millions of tons of radioactive dirt and storing it in plastic bags all over the prefecture. The mountains are highly radioactive, and every time it rains, down comes the radiation with the water. So the radiation, the elements, and there are over 200 radioactive elements made in a nuclear reactor. Some have lives of seconds, and some have lives of millions of years, or last for millions of years, will I say. And so there are many, many isotopes, long-lasting isotopes, cesium, strontium, and tritium is another one, but many, many on the soil in Fukushima. And what happens is, you talked about biomagnification, when the plants take up the water from the soil, they take up the cesium, which is a potassium analog. It resembles potassium. Strontium 90 resembles calcium and the like. And these elements get magnified by orders of magnitude in the rice and in the plants. And so when you eat food that is grown in Fukushima, the chances are it's going to be relatively radioactive. They've been diluting radioactive rice with non-radioactive rice to make it seem a bit better. Now, into the ocean go these isotopes as well, and the algae biomagnify them by, you know, 10 to 100 times or more, and then the crustaceans eat the algae biomagnified more, the little fish eat the crustaceans, the big fish eat the little fish, and the like. And tuna found in off the coast in California some years ago contained isotopes from Fukushima. Also, fish being caught on the coast, west coast of California, contain some of these isotopes. So it's an ongoing biomagnification catastrophe. And the thing is that you can't taste, smell, or see radioactive elements in your food. They're invisible, and it takes a long time for cancers to occur. And you can't identify a particular cancer caused by a particular substance or isotope. You can only identify that problem by doing epidemiological studies, comparing irradiated people with non-irradiated people to see what the cancer levels are. And that data comes from Hiroshima and Nagasaki and many, many, many other studies.
Chernobyl as well, no?
Oh, Chernobyl. Well, a wonderful book was produced by the Russians and published by the New York Academy of Sciences called Chernobyl, with over 5,000 on-the-ground studies of children and diseases in Belarus and the Ukraine and all over Europe. And by now over a million people have already died from the Chernobyl disaster, and many diseases have been caused by that, including premature aging in children, microcephaly in babies, very small heads, diabetes, leukemia. I mean, I could go on and on. And those diseases, which have been very well described in that wonderful book, which everyone should read, are not being addressed or identified or looked for in the Fukushima or Japanese population. May I say that parts of Tokyo are extremely radioactive. People have been measuring the dirt from roofs of apartments, from the roadway, from vacuum cleaner dust, and some of these samples, they're so radioactive that they would classify to be buried in radioactive waste facilities in America. So that's number one. Number two, to have the Olympics in Fukushima is just defies imagination. And some of the areas where the athletes are going to be running, the dust and dirt there has been measured, and it's highly radioactive. So this is Abe, the Prime Minister of Japan, who set this up to as a sort of a way to obscure what Fukushima really means. And those young athletes, you know, who are, and young people are much more sensitive to radiation and developing cancers later than older people. It's just a catastrophe waiting to happen.
Dr. Caldicott,
they're calling it the radioactive Olympics.
Is there anything that people can do, you know, whether they live in Japan or say the west coast of North America, to mitigate the effects that this disaster has had and may still be having 8 years later.
Yes. Do not eat any Japanese food because you don't know where it's sourced. Do not eat fish from Japan, miso, rice, you name it. Do not eat Japanese food, period. Fish caught off the west coast of Canada and America, well, they're not testing the fish, so I don't know what you'd do. I mean, most of it's probably not radioactive, but you don't know because you can't taste it. They've closed down the airborne radioactive measuring instruments off the west coast of America, but that's pretty bad because there still could be another huge accident at those reactors. For instance, if there's another large earthquake, number one, all those tanks would be destroyed and the water would pour into the Pacific. Number two, there could be another meltdown or release, huge release of radiation from the damaged reactors. So things are very tenuous, but they're not just tenuous now. They're going to be tenuous forever.
Dr. Hal Caldicott, it's been good to hear from you. Thank you so much for sharing those thoughts and your expertise with our audience.
Thank you, Mike. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with physician, author, and longtime anti-nuclear campaigner, Dr. Helen Caldicott. She joined us from her home outside Sydney, Australia. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. Fairwinds Energy Education is a 501c3 nonprofit organization founded in 2008 by Maggie Gunderson, a journalist, paralegal, and former atomic power industry spokesperson. Her husband, Arnie Gunderson, is the chief engineer for Fairwinds Associates, Inc. Fairwinds defines itself as a hub for fact-based, undistorted information about nuclear power, with a mission to inform and educate people around the world, legislative officials, and members of the press concerning the scientific and economic issues relating to the production of electricity and the sources of energy used to create power. Arnie Gunderson blew the whistle on the nuclear industry 30 years ago and has since been critical of the industry's tendency to advance its interests at the expense of human health and protection of the environment. Arnie Gunderson is a former senior vice president of the nuclear industry, and he's been very outspoken over the years on the Fukushima incident itself. Arnie, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks. I'm glad I could come.
Now, this week, as you know, is the 8th anniversary of the Fukushima Daiichi meltdowns. Could you speak, first of all, to some of the most significant actions taken by the Japanese government, nuclear regulators, and health authorities to deliberately mislead the public about the dangers posed by the meltdowns, as well as compromise their safety?
You know, I had I traveled frequently with former Japanese Prime Minister Naoto Kan. He was in charge of Japan when the tsunami and meltdowns occurred, and I talked to him about just this very topic. And you know, so this is the top dog in Japan, and he said to me, Arnie, the information I received was neither timely nor accurate. So this is the top dog in Japan, and his own regulator, a group called METI, M-E-T-I, and Tokyo Electric were not telling him the truth. So I think what you've got is an orthodoxy. You've got an atomic priesthood, if you will. And when the orthodoxy is questioned, they circle the wagons and don't tell the truth to the highest elected officials in the land. Same thing happened at Three Mile Island for a while as well.
Well, you were part of that orthodoxy at one point. I mean, when in 30 years ago, you before then, you had been part of that priesthood, as you call it.
Yes, I was. I had a separate conversation with Governor Thornburg 5 years ago at the 35th commemoration of the TMI meltdowns. And Thornburg was the guy running Pennsylvania at the time. He was the governor. And I said to him, you know, Governor Thunberg, you were lied to. Then there was this pause for like 10 seconds, and he looks at me and he smiles. He says, yeah, I was lied to. So here's another example of the orthodoxy, the nuclear industry, lying to public officials. And you're right, I was part of that orthodoxy 30 years ago. I saw, I was on television saying nothing happened, everybody's fine, yada, yada, yada. And I didn't do my own research in that. I just accepted what the higher-ups had told me, almost like an orthodoxy. You know, the priests line up to what the Pope said. Well, it's like that. And it was only in 1990, when I was fired as a nuclear whistleblower, that I began to question the orthodoxy, sort of like a defrocked priest. And Maggie and I saw the same thing happening at Fukushima. We saw the lies, the fact that they said, oh, don't worry, no radiation is getting out. They actually had radiation pills available to limit the iodine uptake in thyroids, and they refused to give them out. I was on television. I committed myself then. Maggie and I both committed ourselves to preventing the playbook that worked so well on TMI to be used again at Fukushima. And to a degree, I think we've been successful.
Now, you yourself have taken Geiger counter readings throughout Japan, and what are some of the more astonishing revelations that you've registered about the ongoing radiation danger?
I have an entry-level professional Geiger counter. It's like a $1,000 Geiger counter called an Inspector by IMI, it measures radiation coming up from the ground, almost like X-ray from, being X-rayed. It measures the cesium giving off radiation from the ground. So that allows me to determine what radiation is entering my body and entering other people's bodies. But it doesn't tell the whole story. And I think that's a critical thing to talk about in this, now that we're 8 years out. The Japanese government is releasing people to go back into areas when their handheld Geiger counters show radiation at 20 rem of radiation, which is 20 times higher than what it had been previously. So, but what's happening is they're ignoring the thing that we found. Not with our Geiger counter, but when we took the samples back to the lab, Dr. Marco Kaltofen and I discovered that there's a lot more in these samples than cesium. And there's a lot more to the discussion than radiation coming from the ground. The key is the hot particles, the very small nano-sized particles, millionths of a meter, that get stirred up and inhaled or imbibed, that then lodge in kidneys or livers or lungs, and over a period of years cause cancers. So you don't pick those particles up with the handheld detector, but the handheld detector gets you in an area where there might be particles, and then we take them to a lab, and the devices we use at the lab are, a scanning electron microscope is a $1 million machine. It costs $300 an hour to run. So it's extraordinarily expensive and difficult for citizens to do adequate science.
These hot particles, they do migrate. It's not like, okay, we had the meltdown and then they just spread out and we can map where it was and clean it up. I mean, they may remain mobile, do they not?
Yes, they do. I was in Minamisoma. Minamisoma is a large town that had been evacuated and then, quote, cleaned by Tokyo Electric, and people came back in. And I was on the roof of the Minamisoma town hall, so it's four stories high. And they had completely cleaned the roof, put a beautiful epoxy coating on the roof, and then put solar collectors on the roof all after the meltdown. And I went over and found a pile of dirt that had collected on the roof and took a sample, and it was highly radioactive. So the question is, how can four stories high become contaminated after the entire town has been cleaned? And the answer is it's blowing back in on the dust. 95% or more of Fukushima Prefecture has not been cleaned, the mountains. And actually, they only clean 50 feet on either side of the roads. So I walked back 90 feet, 30 meters off the road, and found incredibly high radiation readings. So the cleanup is first measured with the handheld devices, and secondly, there's no accounting for the internal exposure, the dust that these people are breathing in day in, day out.
You've heard the expression "too big to fail." I mean, it was in reference to the subprime mortgage scandal and the companies that were bailed out. Too big to fail, and it sounds, from what I've heard and read, that the nuclear industry is protected, even at the expense of the health of the public. As you know, Fukushima being an example, could you maybe go into a little bit of detail about some of the ways in which the protections of the industry are not just human error, but built into the system itself?
I think that's really the entire key to nuclear power, is that these plants are extraordinarily costly to build. The latest one down here in Georgia that's still 5 years from being constructed, it's going to be $30 billion when it's complete. But Three Mile Island was $1 billion, and many other plants were too. So the loss of a single asset, Three Mile Island Unit 2, is something the banking system and the country can withstand. But if you were serious, you would shut down all the nukes. And now you're talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, which is something that neither the nuclear industry nor the banking industry, and of course their lobbyists on Congress, are willing to allow to happen. So they hire scientists who agree with them to turn out papers that agree with them, which makes Fairwinds unique in this sphere. We're publishing, as we can afford, we're publishing papers that counter the orthodoxy. Hmm. Now, in the States, we have Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and it's five commissioners running a staff of a couple thousand engineers. And all five of those commissioners are vetted by NEI, which is the Nuclear Energy Institute, which is the nuclear industry's lobbying arm. So the guard dogs are being appointed by the people they're supposed to be guarding, and that's true in Canada too. You know, I was up there in Toronto discussing the nuclear plant's Pickering, that's very near to Toronto, and I had the same belligerent attitude from the regulator in Canada that I have down here. I was somehow against the orthodoxy, therefore I was wrong. It has morphed into a clique of people that agree on a set of standards and can't think outside the box. And I think that's what Fairwinds does. We think outside the box.
Going back to the specific example of Fukushima, now we're talking about, you know, an attitude so favorable that they'll build nuclear reactors on an earthquake zone. And I mean, that would, most people would find, is that such a good idea? But I think the argument was that the industry was clearly saying is that this earthquake is safe. And as I recall, The authorities were saying that with regard to the Fukushima reactors, that the earthquake didn't do any damage. It was just the tsunami. So just to maybe provide us some understanding, I mean, do we know that the earthquake did no damage to the reactors?
By the way, the Fukushima reactors were designed and built in America. The Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1 was an entirely American design. Then Daiichi Unit 2 had a little Japanese engineering, and finally, by the time they got to Units 5 and 6, they were entirely Japanese. But this is an American design, not a Japanese design. And what happens is the designers get together and determine what they think will be the worst thing to happen. And that's called a maximum credible accident. Maggie and I actually call it the maximum cash available. It's the same MCA. But what they do is they'll say, well, we think the worst earthquake can be whatever and the worst tsunami can be whatever. And they design for that. But if they really looked at what the worst earthquake could be or what the worst tsunami could be, the power plant would be so expensive it could never be built. So there's this trade-off between what scientists know is likely to happen and what can be afforded to make a nuclear power plant competitive. On your question about the seismic issues, there's definitely seismic damage at Fukushima. You can see it in the bracing on the towers, for instance. We have a report up on our site that discusses the seismic problems that Fukushima and Daiichi encountered. And we use the Daiichi experience in discussing problems at Diablo Canyon. So if your listeners go to the Fairwind site and look up an expert report that I wrote on Diablo Canyon, you can see a pretty good discussion of the seismic problems that Fukushima Daiichi encountered. Unit 1 at Fukushima Daiichi had a very weird response to the initial earthquake. The party line is that it withstood the earthquake and was flooded out by the tsunami. But even before the tsunami hit, there were indications on Daiichi Unit 1 that something else was wrong. Of course, the plant is so contaminated, you can't get back in to determine what failed. But I believe there were seismic problems at Fukushima Daiichi Unit 1 that that had already disabled that plant. It was the first to blow up. That had already disabled that plant before the tsunami ever hit. So earthquake standards are reasonable for a standard run-of-the-mill earthquake, but they really never look at the worst that Mother Nature can throw at you. The same thing with tsunamis. They had a 5-meter-high tsunami wall, and it looked impressive. It's like a mini castle. But the tsunami was 15 meters. So suddenly you wind up with 10 meters of water coming over the wall. Now, that wall could have been built taller, and in fact, many scientists said it should have been built taller, but it was too expensive. And so, the business of nuclear power gets into these trade-offs with safety versus expense.
The safety front. We, of course, you recently wrote an article. You referred to attempts by the Japanese government to normalize nuclear power through the 2020 Olympic bid as an atom bomb, BALM. Could you maybe talk, first of all, I mean, they're trying to declare it safe. And my understanding is that the threshold for what's considered safe has been raised. Could you maybe talk about how that could be allowed to happen? Because it seems, at least the way it's presented, it seems like such an obvious attempt at undermining public safety just for the purposes of public relations.
Yeah, that's the crux of the problem in Japan right now. I'll talk in REM, but you can people can convert to sieverts. I grew up with REM as a measure of radiation. And first off, it stands for a Rankin equivalent man, and it's a radiation exposure to a 160-pound man. And women are considerably more radiosensitive, and children are much more radiosensitive than a 160-pound man. So the initial standard of 100 millirem was based on radiation damage to a man of 160 pounds. So what the Japanese realized within a year, the Japanese government and Tokyo Electric realized within a year that they could never clean up Fukushima, the prefecture, which is like a state or a province, the prefecture of Fukushima, back to where it was. And where it was around 100 millirem. So what they did was they changed the standard, and they made it 20 times higher, or 2 rem. And, of course, what that does, because radiation damage is linear with exposure, whatever the radiation risk was at 100 millirem, it's now 20 times higher. So 20 times more people are going to experience radiation-related issues, cancers, but also lots of other issues as well because of this change in the radiation standard. So they increased the standard 20-fold. But, you know, in the run-up to the Olympics, it was much more than that. That was a financial consideration. The only way they could possibly afford the $500 billion to clean it up was to raise the standard. But right after the disaster happened, the Prime Minister Naoto Kan was removed, and there was a kind of an interim Prime Minister. And in November and December of 2011, he declared that the plant was in cold shutdown and therefore safe. Cold shutdown is a term that applies to an intact nuclear reactor, not three that have had meltdowns with holes in the bottom of them. But that the International Atomic Energy Agency and the State Department all climbed on that and said that they're in cold shutdown. It's over. So that was the first. Actually, there's a second lie. The first lie was that Tokyo Electric forbade the use of the term meltdown for 5 months. None of their press people were allowed to mention the term meltdown for 5 months. And, of course, the Japanese press is captured by the industry it covers, and they didn't ask the tough questions about meltdown either. What happens in Japan is if you're part of the press corps covering the nuclear issue, if you ask too many tough questions, they don't invite you back to the next press conference. So that was number one, was they forbade the use of meltdown for 5 months. And secondly, they declared the plants to be in what's called a cold shutdown before the end of 2011. But then Prime Minister Abe took over, and that wasn't enough. He pushed very hard to get Tokyo to be the seat of the Olympics and the Summer Olympics in 2020. They actually call it the Recovery Olympics. They want to show the world that they've recovered from the disaster at Fukushima. And he told the International Olympic Committee that Fukushima was solved. And they also bribed the International Olympic Committee as well some members of the Japanese delegation are under indictment in France for bribing the International Olympic Committee. So the Olympics were placed in Japan, in Tokyo, because Abe wanted to show the world that the radiation damage was over. And I would submit to your listeners that it's more than that. It's the nuclear industry wanted to portray the problem as solved, that nobody was going to die. Look at all these lush green fields and these cattle out there grazing. The problem is solved. And the people that disagreed were, you know, radiophobes. And it's simply not true. The information that Dr. Kaltofen and I have found, and Dr. Tim Mousseau and many others, are showing that the problem is far from solved, and it's going to take a massive amount of money to clean the entire prefecture to levels that are safe, and it's also going to cause cancers. There's no doubt in my mind that there'll be 100,000 additional cancers in Japan. Mm-hmm. Epidemiologically, that's really tough to get to, because the Japanese government's gone out of its way to destroy and limit the available epidemiological information. They're also spreading the radiation all over Japan, so that epidemiologically, you could look at Fukushima Prefecture compared to the rest of Japan and show whether or not, you know, stillbirths and spontaneous abortions and cancers had increased. But what the Japanese government has done is they're taking this nuclear waste and shipping it all over Japan. I was in a Tokyo parking lot, and one of these little concrete bumpers that you drive the wheels up to in the parking lot, I put my Geiger counter on it, and it was highly radioactive. It turns out that the ash from the incinerators in Fukushima is being used to make concrete, which is then shipped all over Japan and used in parking lots. So we run into a very difficult epidemiological problem because the data is being masked.
Okay. I just, in the few minutes we've got left, I can't resist but touch on Three Mile Island, since the 40th anniversary is also this month, and I believe you're going to be presenting at the commemoration in the last week of March. The general public doesn't believe there were any deaths associated with that meltdown. Given that you're intimately familiar with what went down 40 years ago, of course, you're going to be speaking in a couple of weeks. What are some of the main takeaways the public needs to know about Three Mile Island 40 years later?
I'm the keynote speaker at Penn State's 40th commemoration in Harrisburg on the 27th, which is a Wednesday. And hopefully that'll be filmed and eventually we'll have it on our site. But the takeaways are this, that it's the same playbook we've been discussing with Fukushima. The people in Harrisburg and Middletown, Pennsylvania, should have been evacuated within the first 3 or 4 hours of the meltdown. There was a meltdown. There's no doubt about that. But initially the utility lied to the governor and to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Later, however, when there was no evacuation, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did a phenomenal job of covering up for the company it was supposed to be regulating. And this isn't just Arne Gundersen speaking. There's a brilliant report out by a guy named Dr. Henry Myers. And Henry was Mo Udall's science advisor. Mo Udall was a key senator in the 1980s. And Henry's report discusses in depth how the hearings about Three Mile Island just obfuscated the truth, and that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission allowed the management of Three Mile Island to get away scot-free when, in fact, they should have been thrown in jail. The people did die, and victims are being marginalized right now. Dr. Steve Wing, who was an epidemiologist at UNC and a good friend of mine, has a peer-reviewed study that shows that the cancer incidence in the river valley around Three Mile Island is much higher than the cancer incidence further up in the hills. And that was caused because there was a temperature inversion that day, and the radiation from TMI laid in the Susquehanna River Valley, exposing those people, but not the people on the hilltops. So there's good data out there. We have a lot of it on our site. But you're right. The public's perception is that that TMI was a non-event.
Well, I think at that we're going to have to close now. But I think if people want to get more information about some of the articles and videos that you've put up on the climate change is a false solution, the Woolsey fires in California, they can go to that website, fairwinds.org. That's fairewinds.org. Arne Gundersen, thank you so much for your time, sir.
Well, thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it.
We've been speaking with Arne Gundersen. He is the chief engineer for Fairwinds Energy Education. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.